You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
Guns and Butter.
This is Guns and Butter.
There's something happening here. Yeah, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
I think it has to do with driving money offshore into the world's biggest, now today, believe this or not, the world's biggest bank secrecy holding country, bigger than Switzerland, bigger than the Bahamas, bigger than the Cayman Islands, namely the United States of America, including states like Nevada. This is a huge thing, and I think you have to go back to the statement of Henry Kissinger back in the 70s, where he said, if you control money, you control the entire world.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, F. William Engdahl. Today's show, Washington's Dangerous War on Cash, what it's really about. William Engdahl is an international political analyst, economist, and author. He is currently visiting professor of geopolitics at Northwest University, Xi'an, China. Among his best-known books are A Century of War, Anglo-American Oil Politics, and the New World Order, Gods of Money, Wall Street, and the Death of the American Century, and Seeds of Destruction, The Hidden Agenda of Genetic Manipulation, completing a trilogy on the control of oil, food, and money. His latest book is The Lost Hegemon, Whom the Gods Would Destroy, about the CIA and political Islam. Today we discuss his article, The Sinister Agenda Behind the War on Cash, USAID's role in the outlawing of most currency in India, the U.S. as the new tax haven, and an attack on the euro. William Engdahl, good to have you back again.
Well, it's good to be back with you, Bonnie.
In The Sinister Agenda Behind the War on Cash, you write that overnight, Narendra Modi's government in India de facto outlawed an estimated 86% of all cash in circulation by value. That would be 86% of the value of all money in circulation was withdrawn. His surprise announcement was on November 8th, 2016. What exactly has the Indian government done?
This is the most destructive and bizarre act of a state that I can think of in recent history in terms of monetary policy. And what they're doing is forcing people to turn in their 1,000 rupee notes and 500 rupee notes. Now, 1,000 rupee in Western dollar terms is about $15. Most of the Indian economy is informal economy. People, Indians don't trust banks, rightly so. Countries on the upper echelons of the, you know, comparative corruption indices, Transparency International, whatever measures you want to take. It's a very corrupt culture. And certainly the political side of that is extremely corrupt. So people don't trust banks to safeguard their money. They use cash. And the vast part of the economy is a cash economy. So by outlawing, this would be the equivalent of the U.S. Treasury and Trump administration outlawing all cash notes larger than a $10 bill, something like that. And how would you react to that? Oh, $20 bill, $100 bill, you know, $50. You have to bring it into the bank, and you may or may not get the equivalent in $10 bills back, or you just have to depend on electronic digital banking. And Modi, he did a tricky thing. He began by justifying it as a crackdown on the illegal economy. Well, this is nonsense. Then he came out a little more honestly and said, he wants to push the backward Indian people in the villages and the countryside and so forth to get on board digital banking. Well, this is very interesting because it's, as I dug into it, I was just flabbergasted when I read the reports back in November. And as I finally had time to dig into it in some real depth, I found out that the whole scenario of the war on cash of Modi came from the United States Agency for International Development, a cutout for the CIA. And then I wasn't so surprised when I read State Department spokesman Mark Toner back in December at a press briefing. He praised the Modi demonization, saying, "This was, we believe, this is a quote, we believe, an important and necessary step to crack down on illegal actions, a necessary one to address the corruption." Well, what it's done is bankrupted tens of thousands of small shop owners, creating, you know, huge unemployment. But Modi simply seems not to care. He doesn't give a damn about his people. He just, you know, he's there for maybe personal enrichment. I don't know. I had higher hopes when Modi came into the BRICS in a positive way and started talking with China and Russia and so forth. I thought, okay, maybe this is a good development for the Eurasian economic unity. But what India has been doing recently indicates that he simply either lost it or he has been a front for Washington all along.
Well, I read somewhere that half of the people in India don't have electricity or running water. How are these people supposed to go digital?
Well, that's the thing. And half of the people, there's a beautiful word that USAID prepared all the papers on. This is an incredible thing. It's a Washington project to destroy the Indian economy. And they wrote a report back in January last year called Beyond Cash, Why India Loves Cash and Why That Matters for what they call financial inclusion. And all that word inclusion means is one of those nonsense words that's so popular among some people these days. Means getting all Indians into the digital banking system where every single payment can be electronically tracked, given to the government tax authorities or whoever the government sees fit. You can track every purchase that I make. If I decide to go to Russia on holiday, that's going to be tracked by the FBI or the CIA or somebody, Homeland Security. Or if I decide to do this or buy that, then comes a knock on the door and say, why were you buying this and what are that? And in India, almost no retail transactions are done in digital bank transfers. 97% are done in cash or in checks. And only 11% use debit cards to pay. And only 6% of Indian shopkeepers accept digital payments. 94% don't accept them. And only 29% of bank accounts have been used in the last 3 months. Indians don't use banks. It's not like United States. It's a third world country. And to impose this on them. Now, the interesting thing is, who's behind this USAID initiative? And there I found something called the Global Innovation Exchange. Now, what in the world is the Global Innovation Exchange, Bonnie? Well, it turns out it's an organization set up by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, who are always there on the front lines of doing good for people in this world, always there with an arm around the helpless and the poor and the needy to give them GMO Monsanto food products in Africa with the Green Revolution, or what will you? So the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is in there on the Modi cash war. U.S. Department of Commerce is in there, UNICEF, United Nations Development Program, and something really weird, a spooky McLean, Virginia military contractor called MITRE Corporation, whose chairman used to be former CIA Director James Schlesinger, close friend of Henry Kissinger. So this is really getting beyond bizarre. And then there's another organization called Project catalyst of the USAID, which partnered with the Indian Finance Ministry. And there, not only the Bill Melinda Gates Foundation, again, putting their arms around the poor and the needy and anybody who needs a helping hand in this world, our Visa, MasterCard, Omidyar Network of eBay billionaire founder Pierre Omidyar, the World Economic Forum, this gargantuan multi-billion-dollar thing of the globalization annual Alpine meetings, and something called the Better Than Cash Alliance. The Better Than Cash Alliance, what is that? It's based in Washington. It's cooperating with the Indian Finance Ministry. And it seems to be the key public driver of this war on cash. So this thing stinks to high heaven. And then you find that key Western financial mucky-mucks like Larry Summers, the former U.S. Treasury Secretary who repealed Glass-Steagall under Bill Clinton and who played a very shady role in the 1990s rape of Russia through his Harvard cronies, is now calling for eliminating the U.S. $100 bill. It's just like what's going on in India. It's the first step. And in Germany, in the Eurozone, the European Central Bank is calling for eliminating the 500 euro note. The same thing. And they're saying this will make consumers much more efficient in terms of moving money around and But in fact, it's the most totalitarian thing you can imagine. Every move you make, everything you buy will be monitored by Big Brother. And that's the war on cash.
Well, as well, when we talk about India, and obviously they're using India as their first guinea pig, I guess.
Yeah, I think so.
I guess they must figure that if they could pull it off in India, they could pull it off anywhere, because India's not prepared for this.
Yeah.
Is this a recipe to kill off a bunch of the population? I'm reminded of this idea that's been floating around for a few years now of depopulation. Could this be part of it?
It could well be, although I'm not sure that that's the uppermost part of it. Other countries are well along the road of outlawing cash, among them Sweden in the European Union. There you almost have difficulty to find a retailer that will accept cash, only credit cards or bank cards. It started about 2 years ago after a Davos World Economic Forum where this was one of the subjects. And I think it has to do with driving money offshore into the world's biggest, now today, believe this or not, the world's biggest bank secrecy holding country, bigger than Switzerland, bigger than the Bahamas, bigger than the Cayman Islands or the Gibraltar or Jersey Islands, namely the United States of America, including Las Vegas, states like Nevada and North Dakota, South Dakota. So this is a huge thing, and I think you have to go back to the statement of Henry Kissinger back in the 70s, where he said, if you control money, you control the entire world. And if you can get all that money into banks and get everybody going digital, then look what you can do with the digital bank accounts. You can do anything you want with people's money. So this is 1984 on steroids, in my view.
I'm speaking with international political analyst, economist, and author William Engdahl. Today's show, Washington's Dangerous War on Cash, What It's Really About. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. You mentioned that in 2010, the U.S. passed a law, the Foreign Account Tax Compliance Act, or FATCA, that requires financial firms to disclose foreign accounts held by U.S. citizens and report them to the U.S. IRS tax office or else the foreign banks would face steep penalties. Now, when I was living in France around that time, I went to a Democratic Club meeting in Nice for Americans living abroad, and they were discussing this. Americans living abroad there were renouncing their U.S. citizenship and or moving their money, I think, to Monaco. But you write that the United States domestically is one of the very few countries that do not require these bank disclosure rules. How do you interpret this?
Very simple. Well, the United States is in very good company not adopting FATCA. The other countries that have refused are Nauru, a money laundering center island, Vanuatu, and Bahrain. So there you have it. And very simply, we want to impose that on the rest of the world, but we want to open the United States banking system as an offshore banking system. And I think this is a very, very major part of the so-called Panama Papers scandal back last May 2016. That it was designed to panic big money holders who thought they were secure offshore, you know, many of them quite legitimate. If you have an offshore account, it doesn't mean you're a criminal. But they want privacy with their money, and they don't want Uncle Sam snooping about it. Well, after the Panama Papers scandal, money started flowing out of Swiss numbered bank accounts into Reno, Nevada. The business has become so big that the great London bank, N.M. Rothschild & Co., has set up an office in Reno, Nevada. You know, this is something very big going on here. So I think as long as the dollar is the world currency of reference, the U.S. government has enormous power over everybody in the non-cash financial system and make everyone obey American law rather than their international or German law. And look at what they did recently with Germany's largest bank, Deutsche Bank. The U.S. government, unprecedented. First, they were going to impose a $3 billion fine for illegal dealings and dumping subprime mortgages back in 2007, 2008, which they did. Ackerman, then the chairman of Deutsche Bank, bragged about it on German television. By the way, Ackerman should be tried and indicted and put behind bars, in my view. He's no longer head of Deutsche Bank, but he's the one who ruined Deutsche Bank in the last 10 years, 15 years. The U.S. government then suddenly raised the fine from $3 billion to $14 billion, and Deutsche Bank was in the German media was being discussed as a candidacy for state nationalization, which may not have been the worst solution, but of course the American government, with their free market ideology, was very hard-pressed to back away from that. So these are weapons that Washington has developed. You can believe that under Goldman Sachs, as Treasury Secretary Mnuchin, ain't going to play softball with the rest of the world. They're gonna really come down and dirty. And so this whole international bank, the FATCA thing is not operable for U.S. citizens inside the U.S., but the OECD took FATCA and made the OECD is the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, something set up after World War II and based in Paris. But they have groups on money laundering and different things. And they established a global FATCA, far, far tougher than the American FATCA, in 2 years ago, 2014, to go after tax evasion. 97 countries have agreed to this OECD new rules, but the U.S. not, again. So we're talking about a major reorganization of global capital flows. And I think this is very much the Trump economic policy. Peter Navarro, Wilbur Ross, Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary from Goldman Sachs, and so forth.
Now, you've been talking about FACTA, and of course, that's the Foreign Account Tax Compliance Act. When the OECD enacted these rules, is that on behalf of the governments in Europe?
Yes, not only all members of the OECD, which is a huge organization, and 97 countries have agreed to the OECD rules.
Well, that's right. So then all of the banks in all of these countries that have agreed to these rules, where do they report the accounts? Are they reporting them to the U.S. government or to their own governments?
No, to their own governments, yeah. So German accounts in Switzerland have to be reported to the German government, you know, that kind of thing. And a lot of Germans have accounts, well-to-do Germans, not only, but people with life savings, and it's a saving country, have accounts in Switzerland or Liechtenstein, and they value their privacy. Some of them are tax avoiders, of course, but others simply don't want Big Brother knowing what they're doing with their money, and I don't blame them.
So now what is going on with regard to people who are using the U.S. as a tax haven, say, like you pointed out, in Las Vegas, Nevada, or you've written about a few other states in the U.S.? Are people that are putting their money into the United States then not required to report it to the U.S. government and also to their own government? So the U.S. is not going to report this. Is that right?
Yeah, that's my understanding, and that's pretty incredible. The director of Rothschild & Company in the U.S., Andrew Penny, made the comment that the United States today is, quote, effectively the biggest tax haven in the world. Tax haven is where you don't pay taxes because you don't declare it. So, and it's interesting they picked Nevada, Rothschild, because Nevada was set up with legalized gambling back during the Depression by Meyer Lansky, the head of Murder Incorporated, as to become the new Switzerland.
What is Project Catalyst, or Catalyst, Inclusive Cashless Payment Partnership? Now, that is an initiative of USAID, isn't it? You mentioned some of these other organizations.
Yeah, the Project Catalyst is a USAID project in cooperation with the Indian Finance Ministry. And it includes the names I mentioned earlier: Visa, MasterCard, Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, USAID, eBay founder Pierre Omidyar, the World Economic Forum of Davos, and something called the Better Than Cash Alliance, which is one of the key figures in the war on cash. By the way, let me just add an addendum. The Better Than Cash Alliance, I mean, there's so many groups they spin off, you get dizzy here. But the Better Than Cash Alliance has some 50 members. In addition to the Gates Foundation, it includes something called the Citi Foundation of Citigroup Bank, Ford Foundation, which is tightly connected with the CIA historically, MasterCard, United States Agency for International Development, and Visa. So, you know, this is big, big, big. They're trying to go for global control. I don't think it's going to work. I think it's going to blow up in their face, frankly. But they're trying.
Well, I hope you're right. Now, there's also, in addition to, now you've mentioned Project Catalyst, Global Innovation Exchange, Better Than Cash Alliance. Now, what is this cashlesscatalyst.org? That's just another piece of this, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's virtually no difference. It's just spin-offs. So you have a dazzling array of little front groups. It's like what the Communist Party used to do during the 30s in the United States, create all these front groups.
Is there a larger global agenda behind the demonetization or the war on cash move by the government of Modi in India? What is the larger global agenda? Now, obviously, this is a huge move on behalf of many powerful groups. Where do you think this is going so that the U.S. can control the financial system globally? Is that the idea?
Absolutely. I'm convinced. The U.S. is writing the laws. Everybody else has to obey them. If you bring your hot money into the U.S., no questions asked. If you're an American and you want to put your money in a Swiss bank account, you better be careful, boy. So it's total control. There's never been anything like this in history. You know, you could always move a little bit of cash around. Now they're reducing the amount. When I went to my my German bank the other day to make a transfer to another bank of 5,000 euros, I was told that's not allowed by the new rules. Nothing above 4,999 euros is allowed to make on a single day. Well, what if you're buying a house or buying a new car or something like that? You know? So it's really a restriction of basic human freedoms, I would say. And that's where this is going. This is going toward, what can you call it, global fascism.
Wow, that's really shocking. They wouldn't even let you move 5,000 euros from one bank to another bank? That's crazy.
Yeah, in the same city. In the same city. I had to do it in two installments.
Well, as well, I mean, I'm thinking of India, but it would apply to the United States or any country. If they do away with cash, they're going to destroy huge sectors of the economy, aren't they?
In the U.S., I don't think so. In Sweden, Sweden is a very modern economy, you know, I'm sure. And there, they've done this, and it's, you know, Swedes are used to using their credit cards to pay for dinner. You know, to pay for a bus ticket. It's a very common thing. So it's a cultural convenience, and it's safer than carrying, you know, a few hundred Swedish crowns of cash around with you. So, you know, it's not like India, but it's the control. It's the control. Every single thing you buy is going to be. Every book you buy, every record you buy, every DVD you buy, if you go in a restaurant and do this and that, it's total profiling, even more than Facebook and Twitter and all this other social media that the CIA is behind.
It wouldn't simply be a question of running down unpaid taxes. This would be a way as well to follow political dissidents. I had a friend, she was... her husband was going to North Korea. They were from South Korea. They were political activists with regard to North Korea. And she told me this is years ago. They knew immediately that he'd gone to North Korea because it was on his credit card.
Yeah. So it's a digital trail that every move you make, no matter where you go. And I live in Germany. I go to China. I go to Russia quite often on business. I have dear friends in both of those places and so forth. But what if the U.S. government says, okay, that's a criminal act. We know you did this on this and this date and so forth. That's just the kind of thing we're talking about. And we're going from the United States, going to, I don't know, some country in Central America, and then they put that on the blacklist. You know, it's just giving too much power to Big Brother, and I'm against that fundamentally. This is a patriarchic, domina submissive system that's being foisted on us, and it's, you know, it's bad enough before, but this control of the money is fascism pure. No other word for it. I'm talking about Benito Mussolini corporativist fascism, where the state and the banks control trade unions, control people, control every organization from top down.
Well, now, when you said that you didn't think this war on cash ultimately was going to work, why do you say that? It seems to me that they've got such a grip on things. Maybe they could make this work and just let everybody suffer.
Not in the United States. I don't think so. I think we have enough of an independent streak that when people get a whiff of what's going on, if they tried to do this overnight, like in India, there would be 10 million people in the street with baseball bats. going after the Treasury Department. And they haven't tried. They've been very careful so far in the U.S. for that reason, I think.
I'm speaking with international political analyst, economist, and author William Engdahl. Today's show, Washington's Dangerous War on Cash, What It's Really About. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. Well, now, what about in Germany and in Europe? Do you think that the people there are going... It doesn't seem to me that they would be much different than Americans in this regard.
Absolutely. You could not pull this off in Germany today. You could not pull it off. Angela Merkel pulled off this refugee thing. We love you. We're the great Germany, accepting the tired and the poor and the huddled masses. And afterwards, people said, oh, my God, what did we do? But this with the money, I tell you, the Germans have gone through two world wars in the last century in a very, very brutal way. They've lost everything several times in the hyperinflation of the 1920s, the post-war period in the late 40s and 50s. And if there's one thing the Germans will react to, it's when somebody messes with their private savings, their private money. So when this proposal came out, not from German government, but from the European Central Bank, which is headed by an Italian, Mario Draghi, former Goldman Sachs guru, the head of the Bundesbank came out and said, I don't think this is an idea that will be accepted by German people, when they wanted to eliminate the 500-euro note. So, you know, even that august institution of the finance said, it ain't going to fly here. So I don't think it will. I don't think it will.
Oh, so they haven't outlawed the $500 euro note.
No. They talk about it, but they haven't done it yet.
I see. Now, a lot of the excuse given for the war on cash is to eradicate corruption and underground economies, black money. But it's not going to have that effect, right? Because what I've heard about, particularly in India, the black money is, it's not held by little people with cash. It's all going out of the country, or it's in gold. It's
gold. It's
being controlled by the wealthy, and this is not going to affect them, right?
Not at all. That's the point, yeah. And the big money movers, dirty money movers, the drug cartels and so, they'll dance circles around this. There's no problem for them. They'll just open an account with N.M. Rothschild in Reno, Nevada, and bring their drug money profits there and take it out of Switzerland.
Now, let me clarify something about what's going on in the U.S. Obviously, the U.S. government, let's say I have a bank account, that information is available to the government, isn't it? How would these tax havens work in this country? Would it go by the states? Would they not be reporting this money to the U.S. government?
This I don't know. This we have to look at. But when they say an offshore money center, they're talking about foreign bank accounts. Let's say a German billionaire, Baron Borna Meza or Thyssen, wants to put his billions in a Reno account with N.M. Rothschild because he's afraid of Switzerland disclosure and da-da-da-da. Nobody is going to tell the Swiss government that the Baron has put his money in Reno, Nevada through N.M. Rothschild. And this is why the economic team of Donald Trump, including his new ambassador to the European Union, are talking about trillions of dollars coming into the United States in the next years. They're counting on a massive macro shift of global capital flows into the U.S. economy. And that's a huge thing. It's going to... I just completed a piece that will be posted on the internet and on my website, williamengdahl.com, in probably the next week, about Trump's comments and Navarro, Peter Navarro, his trade advisor, comments about Germany being a currency manipulator. And I think what they're doing is preparing to destroy the euro, and it wouldn't be very hard right now. So we could talk about that for a moment if you want.
Well, I'd love to talk about that.
He has created a new position of trade czar, if you want to call it that, named Peter Navarro. And Peter Navarro is a very, very much hardliner on. He's the one that recommended to scrap the Trans-Pacific TTP and the Transatlantic TTIP, or whatever it's called, and also renegotiate NAFTA. He said the Chinese are currency manipulators and they have, ruined our domestic economy and our jobs. There's certain truth to some of these statements as well, don't deny. But then now he's focused on Germany as a currency manipulator. And this is very interesting. Currency manipulator is a term used by the U.S. Treasury. It's been applied to three nations, including Japan, in the last 30, 40 years. It's very seldom used. But to accuse Germany of being a currency manipulator, Merkel responded by saying monetary policy of Germany is not controlled by Germany, but by the European Central Bank by treaty agreement. And they are independent, so we have no control even if we wanted to. And on paper, that's correct. But the reality is the European Central Bank was set up by Helmut Kohl and the Germans in 1994 to 1999 to reflect the advantage of Germany, fix forever the relation between Portugal, Italy, France, and Greece, and these countries, to the advantage of Germany. So I think thereafter, they're going to knock out the euro. I'm sympathetic to that in a certain way, I have to confess, because I never for once, as an economist, subscribe to the euro as anything positive. It's a complete misconception. It's a banker's concept of a future Europe as a superpower and not a European concept for European populations.
Well, with the euro, all of the countries lose their sovereignty and they can't, the European countries can't issue their own debt, right? And so it is a disaster on that level. I didn't know that the European Central Bank was set up to favor Germany.
Mm-hmm. This I followed as a journalist, as a financial journalist, in great detail at the time during the 90s, going to Brussels and banking conferences and so forth, talking to almost everybody, including Hans Dietmeyer, the head of the Bundesbank at the time. The history of the euro is quite fascinating because in 1991, there was a European Heads of State conference in Maastricht, Holland, by all the heads of government of the European Economic Community, it was called back then, a very loose kind of federation. And suddenly, out of the blue, Helmut Kohl, who was chancellor at that time, was confronted by Italy, Britain, and France, Mitterrand of France, John Major of Britain, who replaced Thatcher, and Andreotti of Italy, three of the most cunning politicians of the European community. And they demanded of Germany, of Kohl, the surrender of the Deutschmark and the power of her Bundesbank central bank, at that time the most respected central bank in the world, to a new independent supranational structure that became known as the European Central Bank. And Kohl was completely caught off guard. I know this from people who were present as journalists there at the Maastricht talks. And Kohl was completely shocked. And he said, well, Germany's position is first we should have a political union before we can have a monetary union. And they said, no, this is how we're going to do it. If you want to have a unified Germany, Germany is going to become such a powerhouse economically that we, other European countries, want to control Germany through the European Central Bank. So in the beginning, as you can imagine, Helmut Kohl was foot-bragging on embracing the euro, or what became the euro. And then, here's the interesting part. A friend of mine, a very close friend of mine, who's an economist and a banker from Denmark, spoke at a conference in London in 1994 with Henning Christophersen. Christophersen recently passed away, so I feel at liberty to reveal this. And Christophersen was the Danish commissioner under Jacques Delors, the president of the European Commission, for economics and currency relations in the European Economic Community, primarily responsible for hammering out what became the euro. And he was privy to all the debates and discussions among the governments of the future euro. And he told this Danish friend of mine over drinks after this conference, and I know this friend very well, he didn't distort this at all, said the attitude of Germany, especially Helmut Kohl, toward introduction of a single euro has changed 180 degrees since 1991. And my friend said, why this? And he said, well, look at what's happened in European banking. Since 1991, the French banks are in the existential crisis. Credit Lyonnais, they're all in disastrous shape. Italy, the same thing. And just hanging on by a thin lifeline, which they still are, by the way. And the British banks were in their deepest real estate debt crisis. And the German banks, Deutsche Bank and the other top German banks, convinced Kohl that if Germany does it right, the euro can secure Germany at the head of Europe for the next century or more. And a little bit after this, I was at a banking conference in Frankfurt, sponsored by the Frankfurt banks, the big German banks. And the guest keynote speaker was Helmut Kohl. And I thought, okay, let's hear what he has to say. And Kohl gave the most passionate speech I'd ever heard him give on television or elsewhere, but this was in person. He said, the euro is the key to bind Europe so that no future war between European nations will be possible. And the bankers there gave him a standing ovation. In other words, Helmut Kohl was 150% behind the euro for this reason. So when Navarro and Trump start attacking German BMW imports, threatening 35% import tariffs and so forth, they're not only talking about BMW, they're talking about the euro and Germany as a currency manipulator. And there's a certain amount of truth to that. But the deeper point is Washington under Trump is out to dismantle this eurozone as a potential threat to the dollar as world currency reserve. That's the basis for U.S. power. The dollar is currency reserve and the U.S. military is the largest military in the world. If you lose either one of those, game up, game over. So it's a fascinating thing. The Trump economic agenda, if you read the background papers of Peter Navarro, the new trade czar, and Wilbur Ross, the new commerce secretary, they wrote it together. And look at the comments of the Trump nominee for Brussels ambassador to the EU. They're talking about the end of the euro. They're talking about going short on the euro. And this is going to be a big global shock.
I'm speaking with international political analyst, economist, and author William Engdahl. Today's show, Washington's Dangerous War on Cash, What It's Really About. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. Does the euro really threaten the dollar, a number one, or are they trying to take it down or attack Europe so that the money from Europe would flow into the U.S.?
I think both. The euro, the reason for the Greek crisis, as I wrote at the time, back in 2010, when suddenly it was discovered that the Greek government had cheated on its Maastricht criteria for deficit and public debt, came from Goldman Sachs. Goldman Sachs, in 2002, had set up the arrangements, the derivative arrangements, to allow the Greek government to hide their true fiscal state from Brussels so they could stay in the euro. And then suddenly that came to light. And it came to light at precisely the time the Chinese were threatening to pull out of the dollar from its treasury bonds because the U.S. debt levels were going astronomically higher under Bush and then Obama. So this was currency war. This was a U.S. currency war to eliminate the euro as an alternative to the dollar as world reserve, which it was threatening at that point to become. But now I think they just want to get rid of the euro as a potential at all. They just get the damn thing off the agenda. Let's deal with national currencies. Let's deal with the Deutschmark, the French franc, and so forth. Ironically, if the European politicians weren't so damn corrupt, they could see this as an opportunity to get back from a bad deal in the beginning. But they're damn corrupt. So they're going to fight tooth and nail to hold on to this dysfunctional euro. It's a very interesting fight that's shaping up.
If the countries in Europe go back to national currencies, obviously each country could issue its own debt, et cetera. It would solve a lot of economic problems. But then the smaller countries with smaller economies, they would be more easily manipulated by Wall Street, say, wouldn't they? I mean, wouldn't they be in even more danger, perhaps?
I don't think so. Look at Greece. You know, Greece and the euro was smashed by Wall Street.
Well, that's true.
I think I'm very firm that borders matter. Borders, I've said this before, I think, on your program, Bonnie, but human borders matter. If somebody tries to violate my space, I'm within my rights to defend my space, especially if they try violently. And the same thing with nations. National sovereignty, I don't think, is passé. I don't think it's a relic. I think this is essential to existence on this planet, at least in the state the world is in right now. We're not so advanced that we can all treat each other as brothers in love and human beings and so forth. We just ain't there. So let's take the state of the art and say, at least let's defend our national borders. So I think it wouldn't be the worst thing in the world that would happen to Europe. De Gaulle had a vision. He called Europe of the fatherlands. And he meant that the agreements between that time, I think 10 or 12 nations of the European Economic Community, should be between sovereign governments. It's beneficial for Germany, it's beneficial for Belgium, it's beneficial for, so to eliminate border controls and this, that, and the other thing. And there's no downside. It's not beneficial to do this, so we leave that off the table. Item by item, you negotiate this as national governments. But now you have this unelected, faceless bureaucracy in Brussels, fascism pure. I keep coming back to this word because if listeners don't know what this word means, if they know it only as an emotional word, they should look it up in detail in the historical dictionary. This is fascism pure, what exists in Brussels. There are no democratic checks and balances. The European Parliament has no democratic checks and balances. The European Commission, no democratic checks and balances. This came clear in the glyphosate controversy last summer. Glyphosate is the most widely used, you know, weed killer herbicide in the world. It's used in Monsanto Roundup. It's used in almost every. And it's been proven by the World Health Organization to be a probable carcinogen. Well, that's pretty alarming. I think if I were a responsible European Commission, I would say, let's put a freeze on spraying our crops and our gardens and our schools with glyphosate until we settle this question. And there were a million petitions signed by European citizens saying the same thing. There were teams of scientists that said the same thing. And the Brussels commissioner responsible for the health of the European population said, okay, we make a compromise. We renew the license for 18 months. And now it's come out in independent studies that glyphosate in micro concentrations, much smaller than is recommended by the European Union or the EPA in the U.S., causes fatty liver disease, causes horrendous health issues and death. So, you know, because it's supposedly to the benefit of farmers to keep this on the market, they allow this to poison to be sprayed on our crops for another year and a half. I think this is eugenics. I think this is population reduction on a scale in Brussels. I can't come to any other conclusion. It's criminal.
If the euro were done away with and the countries of Europe went back to their nation state status, then what's going to happen with Germany?
Hopefully more sensible policies. You know, I've lived in Germany for 30 years and I've watched this country go from a rather decent, functioning consensus society to a top-down, I would call it dictatorship. Angela Merkel says, and you click your heels and you obey. And it didn't start out that way. Even Helmut Kohl was a brutal political fighter. Didn't do such things. So, and Deutsche Bank, just look at that, from the assassination by the CIA of Alfred Herrhaus, the chairman of Deutsche Bank, who had a plan in 1989, and he was a close economic advisor of Helmut Kohl on the question of Eastern Europe and Russia at the collapse, you know, the collapse of the Soviet Union. He had a project for building high-speed rail links between Berlin and Moscow. Infrastructure, economic ties. You know, if you don't have trade, you have war. And Washington said, let's have war. So they assassinated Herrhausen. The rest is history.
Yes, his name was Herrhausen, right?
Alfred Herrhausen. I heard him speak in Frankfurt several times. He was very charismatic and a brilliant man. Very educated. He had a vision for Germany and a vision for debt relief for Poland and other countries that simply Wall Street couldn't stomach.
What year was he assassinated?
He was assassinated just at the beginning of the German, when the Berlin Wall fell down. That was November 1989. And he was assassinated just a few days after that. Yeah, in the end of November. 9th of November, the wall came down, the Berlin Wall. You remember this historic event when people were dancing on the wall and
yeah,
the people coming across. It was very moving. People, the symphony was playing Beethoven's Ode to Joy. And then on 30th November, outside his home, he was blown sky high. It was said by something called the Red Army faction, the terrorist group. The sophistication of that operation points to CIA and U.S. intelligence. They're the only ones who had the motive to blow him out of the picture, because he would have created an entirely different economic space between Germany and Russia. And that's something the head of Stratfor, George Friedman, said in an interview a couple of years ago, said, it's been U.S. strategic policy for more than a century to prevent an alliance between Germany and Russia. And I maintain that's a very foolish policy. It was also the British policy, and it's led to two world wars. Let nations come together. You know, the United States could benefit from a thriving, healthy European economy. But they seem to, the people who are in charge in Wall Street, who've made a coup d'etat over the political institutions of America in the last 30 years, what I talk about in the Gods and Money book, you know, they don't want that. They just want money, money and power.
Yes. I did have a someone on the show who talked about that assassination of Herrhausen. I'm glad you went over that. That's very important.
Mm-hmm. It was very important. It was a decisive. And a few months later, the head of the Treuhand for Helmut Kohl, the agency entrusted with reorganizing the East German communist economy, the state economy, and privatizing all these factories and workers and so forth, Detlev Rohweder, was also assassinated in his sitting in his living room on Sunday afternoon by Red Army faction. This is all CIA dirty tricks, black operations. And what that did was to just completely knock the economic policy of the German government from one of building infrastructure, something the Germans do very well, by the way, or did very well, to one of turning East Germany into a tourist attraction instead of a high technology industrial area, which everyone was expecting in Germany a year before, and turning Russia into a target for plunder, for looting.
William Engdahl, thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Bonnie. I always enjoy talking with you.
Something happening, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
I've been speaking with F. William Engdahl. Today's show has been Washington's Dangerous War on Cash, What It's Really About. William Engdahl is an international political analyst, economist, and author. Among his best-known books are A Century of War, Anglo-American Oil Politics and the New World Order, Gods of Money, Wall Street and the Death of the American Century, and Seeds of Destruction, The Hidden Agenda of Genetic Manipulation, completing a trilogy on the control of oil, food, and money. His book Target China, How Washington and Wall Street Plan to Cage the Asian Dragon, has been a bestseller in Chinese. His latest book is The Lost Hegemon, Whom the Gods Would Destroy, about the CIA and political Islam. Visit WilliamEngdahl.com to sign up for a free bi-monthly geopolitical newsletter. That's WilliamEngdahl.com. Guns and Butter is produced by Bonnie Faulkner, Yara Mako, and Tony Rango. Visit us at gunsandbutter.org to listen to past programs, comment on shows, or join our email list to receive our newsletter that includes recent shows and updates. Email us at faulkner@gunsandbutter.org. Follow us on Twitter at G&B Radio.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
New World Notes.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. Return with us now to the 1950s. Not everyone back then believed that progress meant the atom bomb and bigger tail fins. This installment is called Gene Shepherd versus Creeping Meatballism, and I hope you'll stay tuned. Last week's show was mainly a long monologue on the search for authenticity, with or without a motorcycle. At the very end, I mentioned two synonyms for the opposite of authenticity, plastic and creeping meatballism. Since then, I've been thinking that creeping meatballism could use a little more explanation. Credit for that term goes to radio great Gene Shepherd. In the buttoned-down, suburbanized America of the 1950s, there were a few disruptive voices to be heard. One of them belonged to late-night radio personality Gene Shepherd on WOR AM and FM in New York City. Late at night, five nights a week, Shepherd would talk for long stretches about, apparently, whatever came to mind. Door-to-door salesmen, tail fins on cars, magazine advertisements, history, sports trivia, books, and also the very unimpressive nature of what people liked to call progress. In any show, he'd weave together a half dozen topics that no one had ever woven together before, or since. Donald Fagen of Steely Dan wrote a fine essay on Gene Shepherd. Fagen said that the best term for Shepherd's art is word jazz. No offense to Ken Nordine. And I think Fagen is right. Word jazz. We'll hear Shepherd himself in the second half of this show. But back to creeping meatballism. In 1957, Shepherd published an essay in Mad magazine, of all places. Mad was a better magazine back in 1957. So was the Atlantic Monthly, but don't get me started. Anyway, the article was titled, The Night People versus Creeping Meatballism. Now some definitions. The night people are the good guys. Shepherd's late-night listeners, perhaps. The hip people, independent thinkers. Their opposite is the day people. The conformists, the mindless consumers, the Pepsi generation. People who believe that if it's heavily advertised, it must be worth buying. People who have no original thoughts in their heads. That's the day people, and the world they live in is called the day world. And the name for their philosophy of life is creeping meatballism. Today, their grandchildren walk the streets. They're easy to spot. They're the ones who feel so much better about themselves because they've upgraded their Apple iPhone 5 to the latest Apple iPhone 6. Progress marches on. But return with us now to yesteryear, to 1957. And to judge from Shepherd's article, nothing really has changed since then, except cars lost their tail fins. Let's put on a little period background music and have a listen to Gene Shepherd's essay. I've condensed it a little. The Night People versus Creeping Meatballism. Shepherd writes, in the language of day people, I suppose night people may be called many things, like soreheads, wise guys, eggheads, long hairs, outsiders, etc. Whatever they're called, the fact remains they're a genuine phenomenon. They're the people who refuse to be taken in by the day-world philosophy of creeping meatballism. The average person today thinks in certain prescribed patterns. People today have a genuine fear of stepping out and thinking on their own. Creeping meatballism is this rejection of individuality. It's conformity. The American brags about being a great individualist, but actually he's the world's least individual person. The guy who has been taken in by the meatball philosophy is the guy who really believes that contemporary people are slim and clean-limbed, and they're so much fun to be with because they drink Pepsi Cola. As long as he believes this, he's in the clutches of creeping meatballism. He's a day people. Let me give you some examples of creeping meatballism at work. We'll take something that's artistically interesting, and then, because we like it, we'll overdo it 10 times, thereby destroying it. Like, for example, when Cadillac first came out with those little tail fins. Everybody thought it was great. Guys with Chevys and Pontiacs went out and bought phony tail fins, which they tagged on. And all the car manufacturers began to see that there was a thing here. So the next thing you know, every car has fins. A couple of years ago, we had a horsepower competition. Now there's a fin competition. In the day world, the car with the highest and longest fin is the car everybody's interested in. I go into a drugstore to buy a small tube of toothpaste for my traveling kit, which is the only size it will take. And I say, I want a small tube of toothpaste. And the clerk says, okay, and he gives me this tube, and on the side it says large. So I say, what's this? I want the small one. And he says, this is the small one. And I say, it says here, large. And he's getting irritated because I'm beginning to probe into his psyche. This has bothered him a little bit, but he's never said anything before. Well, the large is the smallest they make, he says. Which means it is totally impossible in the day world to buy anything that's small, even if you try. Today, everything has a badge. Take men's suits. I go into Macy's basement, where they sell cheap men's clothing. And incidentally, they don't call them cheap. They call them budget-minded. And here they have this big rack of men's suits, and it says custom brand. And I say, custom-designed suits? Who are they designed for? I thought custom-designed meant designed for an individual. And the salesman says, well, you see, they're designed for us, the basement. That means it's impossible in the day world to buy a standard rack suit. All suits are custom designed, even if they're designed for the rack, and they fit the hangers beautifully. Today, no man is without a medal. I know a department store where they had all day people working, and these people began to rail at being called employees. There's something about being called an employee which makes you sound like a second-rate citizen. So the guys upstairs started to think about this, and they figured the best thing to do was to change the name. So now, all the people who work for this particular department store are no longer called employees, but associates. And everybody's happy. They've had about a 25% decrease in quitting, fistfights, etc. Because they're associates now. It's impossible to be an employee there. Just as it's impossible to buy a car without fins, or a small tube of toothpaste, or a standard rack suit. Here's a wonderful example of creeping meatballism. On Wide, Wide World one week, they took these cameras down to Florida, and they said, a lot of you people have never been to Florida, and you want to know how Florida looks. So, here's Florida! And they showed all these palm trees and girls in bathing suits, and it looked like Florida. Only what happened was, when they took the cameras down and set them up, it didn't look the way they thought Florida should look. So they actually went out and got 25 prop palm trees and set them all around, and got some girls to walk around in bathing suits, even though nobody wore bathing suits in that part of Florida. And all the meatballs all over the country sat there and said,
Yeah, by George, there's Florida, all right. That's the way Florida looks. Which means that creeping meatballism has taken hold of geography. There's a great deal of confusion about what is progress. I think one of the fine examples of the difference between day people and night people can be observed when they both watch Betty Furness do a commercial for Westinghouse. You know, the one where she says, "Another new miracle has been wrought. Mankind once again progresses. The new Westinghouse refrigerator for 1957 opens from both sides." Well, a day people sitting there says, "By George, we really are getting ahead." And he feels great. He can see mankind taking another significant step up the great pyramid of civilization. But a night people watching this thing can't quite figure out what's the advantage of a refrigerator which opens from both sides. All he wants to know is, does it keep the stuff cold? He's not quite sure there's been any great mark of progress while there's still wars and stuff going on. Every one of us, I don't care who he is, has a certain amount of night people in him. Because no matter how many refrigerators you buy from Betty Furness, no matter how many custom suits you buy, no matter how many cars with fins you buy, you're still an individual. And I'll say this. Once a guy starts thinking, once a guy starts laughing at the things he once thought were very real, once he starts laughing at TV commercials, once he starts getting a boot out of movie trailers, once he begins to realize that just because a movie is wider or higher or longer doesn't mean it's a better movie, once a guy starts doing that, he's making the transition from day people to night people. And once this happens, he can never go back. Or so says Gene Shepherd in his celebrated 1957 essay, "The Night People versus Creeping Meatballism." Okay, this piece is not a radical analysis. For Shepherd, it's all up to the individual. The word corporation never appears here, let alone capitalism. There's no inkling in the essay, for instance, that there's a whole field of study called industrial psychology. And through empirical research, that field discovered that employers can extract more labor from their workforce at less cost by giving employees a false belief in their own power and a false belief in their own importance to the company. That's the reason why department store stock boys are called associates rather than stock boys. They don't do it just to be silly. They do it to maximize profit. Shepherd's essay reveals no understanding that the economic elite and the political elite benefit from citizens turned into unthinking, conformist consumers. The economic and political elite profit from creeping meatballism, and they work hard to perpetuate it. That's not Gene Shepherd talking, that's me. Among entertainers, George Carlin and Bill Hicks caught on to this. And maybe Donald Fagen, too, speaking of. Think of Steely Dan's song, "The Royal Scam." But not as early as 1957 they didn't. So we'll cut Gene Shepherd some slack for his lack of radicalism. Also, the guy needed to keep his job. But if Shepherd wasn't there yet in the 1950s, you could hear he was on the right track. And you shall hear in a minute. He was very good at debunking the sense of progress that the day people celebrated. And he was very good at debunking our increasingly abstract mechanisms of credit and exchange, like those newfangled credit cards and green stamps. Are you old enough to remember S&H green stamps? I remember green stamps in the 1950s. Postage stamp-sized stamps. The supermarket would give you a certain number of them based on how much you had spent. Back then, I got to lick the green stamps and paste them into a special book. fill up enough books, and you could go to a redemption center and trade in your stamps for a new toaster, or a waffle iron, or a set of chrome-plated swizzle sticks. Your choice. We'll hear about 10 minutes from Shepherd's show of May 2, 1959. He talks about green stamps and credit cards and the false notion of human progress. He talks about the heroic sacrifice of Ronald Metzger. He recites some real advertisements and some fake advertisements, too. And there's much other stuff, too, which I had to cut out. Shepherd doesn't use the term creeping meatballism here, but that's basically what he's talking about. When you hear a beep, that's where I snipped out a bunch of stuff. But first, a word from our sponsor.
Enter the colossal Around the World contest. Details at the Grand Union near you. Save cash and stamps at Metropolitan New York, New Jersey Grand Union supermarkets. You know, they're working out a scheme to give green stamps for your life. I mean, you know, we have developed this new philosophy of nobody ever really pays for anything, really. In the end, he gets enough green stamps back, and he gets enough discounts so that nobody ever really shells out. You realize that, of course. Slowly but surely, mankind is gradually inching himself forward towards that great, great golden glow in the horizon that he's been going after on his hands and knees ever since the first one crawled out of the first primeval mud puddle and shed his last pair of vestigial gill covers. And he says, look at that light over there, Charlie. Let's go. And so they started to crawl toward the light. Everybody left their caves and started to crawl toward the light. And we've been crawling toward it ever since. We're getting close to it now with the green stamps, you know, and everything. We'll be there yet one day. Right there in the middle of all that light. Yes, Ronald Metzger was a man with a mission. Find out what Ronald Metzger did for all of us. These and other thrilling moments will be yours in the next 45 minutes on the Harold Murchison Show, brought to you by the Fulfillment Corporation of America. Guaranteed to make your life richer, deeper, with more significance, and certainly more meaning to each and every one of you, which is all of us, really, in a way. We've been digging for this. Dear Mr. Shepherd, did you know that one of Merrill Hoag's feet was size 6.5 and the other size 4.5? Signed, the baseball fan. How's that for a statistic? Ronald Metzger was a man with a mission. You'll find out what Ronald did for all of us before the end of this program. Yes, this is the Fulfillment Corporation of America once again greeting you as a friend. Put her there, friend. Yes, we're your friend. We're going to fulfill you. Oh, boy, it's going to be a great, deep, wonderful, singing, beautiful, rich, verdant life before it's all over. So come on, put your hand out in a friendly, soldier-like fashion. Here's the thing that speaking of that, you know, have you ever felt that you don't have the secret? Somebody sent me this clipping, and they said, Dear Mr. Shepherd, here is a note on how to make big money in the senator business. And this makes me kind of, I feel this inside of me. I will read this to you without comment. Helpful hints on the art of making and keeping friends were given recently by a man who has spent his public career as a human relations practitioner. I thought he was a legislator. Senator Lyndon Johnson. Among those best applicable to life insurance. 1. Listen to the things you must do to make money in the senator business. And maybe you can apply these to your poor little miserable sniveling life. Maybe it'll work out for you after all. 1. Learn to remember names. 2. Be a comfortable person so that there's no strain in being with you. Be relaxed and easygoing so that things don't ruffle. Here's a kind of a nice one. Study the scratchy elements of your personality, even those of which you may be unconscious. That's going to make it very easy. That's a very simple thing to do, to study the scratchy elements of your personality, particularly those parts of which you are unconscious. And I'll tell you how you can do that. Scratchy elements in your personality. I wonder if Voltaire had a lot of scratchy elements. Jonathan Swift. All kinds of little scratchy things sticking out. How to make money in the senator business. So don't give up. Ronald Metzger was a man with a mission. And it's going to work out. I'm in a very embarrassing... This is the paperback gallery. Ronald Metzger, do you have my gothic music there, please? I think that we might as well level and tell you what Ronald Metzger did for us. But before we do that, fellow sufferers, I see where this... I saw this little note in the Times. I suppose you saw it in the... I'm a great fan of want ads and stuff. It says for sale, fully equipped 100 million volt electron accelerator in good operating order, built by General Electric Corporation, served as a fine instrument for basic research laboratory, the University of Chicago. You know what that is, don't you? That's an atom smasher. It's a 100 million volt atom smasher. Wouldn't that make a wonderful hobby? I mean, it really would. This thing is a giant thing. You could have it installed. It's much more fun than ham radio, Jimmy. You have it, and it's a certainly, because most of the guys who are interested in ham radio are not interested in talking to anybody. They're interested in the gadgets. Where would you put it? In your basement. Yeah, it's true. It's not portable mobile, and you can't work anybody on six with it. Oh, think of the fun you'd have. Can't you just hear him? Boom! The neighborhood rocks. They say, that's old Charlie down there. That's old Jimmy. He's smashing some atoms tonight. Boom! By George, he gets fun out of life. Boom! Yes, sir, he sure really digs. Boom! He has more fun than anybody. 100 million volt one. It's very, very easy. They have a buy now, pay later plan. So you can extend it indefinitely. Everything. They're fixing out a credit card so you won't ever have to pay for your life. You know, I have a feeling that one day we're going to be born. When people are born, they're going to be automatically given a special non-wear-outable card which is attached to their hand, which is their universal credit card for life. And they just charge everything all through their life. And, of course, capital punishment would be the tearing up of that credit card by the judge. He just tears up the credit card and you're done. You have to skulk out in the bushes back of the Howard Johnson's forever and ever and ever. We have a communique. What did I do with it? A communique from a guy who sent me a wire, and he said that the Howard Johnson at the New Bedford Exchange on the Pennsylvania Turnpike now has 26 flavors in stock, in spite of the big sign that says 28. But he says that's the best he's hit yet. Yes. So we're moving along. Oh, boy, here's where I... Listen to this. Don't you feel gothic? Don't you feel like you got little gargoyles growing out of your ears? And your eyes are long, slanted, tall, thin windows with deep panes of blue stained glass peering out over a rich, moving, undulating gray world, made of old granite, pockmarked by the erosion of time. Gothic. Ronald Metzger was a man with a mission. He climbed into his farm truck, drove to Marshall, Illinois, swung the truck onto the sidewalk, and bowled it clear around the square, shearing off 33 parking meters like corn stalks. He whooped with glee. Woo-hoo! The sheriff jumped onto the running board to break up the game, but Metzger pushed him off. Metzger later declared from behind bars that his only regret was that he had missed two of the offending meters. You realize that Ronald Metzger gave it up for all of us? He did it. This is a brief eulogy to Ronald Metzger behind bars in Marshall, Illinois. Oh, Ronald, we know that you are a man among men. We stand awed. We stand, nay, indeed, in the shadow of thy immense image, O Ronald Metzger of Marshall, Illinois. We realize, of course, that there are but few men who can ever rise to the great heights of attainment and courage and tenacity such as you have. That the sort of courage you showed was courage far and above and beyond the call of usual civilian duty. The kind of courage that rises above and above and above the small modicum of animal-like, ferret-like courage that we have in our tiny grain-like lives. And so Ronald Metzger, man among men, who got into his farm truck and drove to Marshall, Illinois, swung his truck around the sidewalk and sheared off 33 parking meters, doing it for all of us. Ronald Metzger, we can but stand and salute thee. Avant, avant, O Metzger. There, he gets the note of supreme ecstatic joy. That's in New York. And don't forget, the Grand Union special today is ready-to-eat smoked hams. Full-cut, shank half, only 39 cents a pound. Details at the Grand Union near you. Save cash and stamps at Metropolitan New York, New Jersey, Grand Union supermarkets. Harold Murchison here. We'll be back tomorrow night at 9:30 for the fist fight hour.
The incomparable Gene Shepherd, radio broadcast from May 2nd, 1959, with a further analysis of creeping meatballism. And why you want to be one of the night people, not the day people. And with that, I will bid you adieu, first thanking you for listening to New World Notes. On the web, find us at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. And on that very page, you will find my email address. And if you'd care to write, I'd be glad to hear from you. Or you can leave a comment on the webpage. That's newworldnotes.blogspot.com. We come to you from the spacious underground studios of WWUH-FM, a community service of that beacon of light in darkest Connecticut, the University of Hartford. For New World Notes, this is Kenneth Doust. Illegitimite non carborundum. Please keep the aspidistra flying, and, as Gene Shepherd always liked to say to the night people, Excelsior!
It is the Taylor Report, 89.5 FM, Toronto. And I believe we're joined by the author, Stephen Gowans. Are you there, Stephen?
Yes, I am. Hello, Phil.
Stephen, it's good to talk to you. Thank you very much. I just told people, I'm going to tell them again, that you're going to be speaking in New York. We do have some New York listeners. And so on the 14th of this month, and that's Bastille Day, right?
That is definitely Bastille Day.
Yes. Well, Steve Gowans is going to be speaking at the Solidarity Center at 7 p.m., 147 West 24th Street and the second floor. And it's the handsoffsyriacoalition.net that is organizing the meeting. And, of course, that's based on Stephen's report on his book, discussing his book, Washington's Long War on Syria. Now, Stephen, you have an article that we want to ask you about, the sesquicentennial, and titled Humanity on Canada's Sesquicentennial, What Does Humanity Have to Look Forward To, Not What Canada Represents. We want to ask you about that. But first, since the Syria book has got a lot of attention, people, and I know you've been touring and talking, we have to ask you about latest news from about the war in Syria. And I guess the big story is this one that is that perhaps Syria is, according to the Trump administration, thinking of using chemical weapons again. not that they ever did in the first place. But that story, despite Trump's reputation, always seems to get traction. And it comes at a time when U.S. forces or their allies aren't really doing that well in Syria. Tell us what you make of this story.
Well, that story gets traction, but Seymour Hersh's story gets no traction at all. Seymour Hersh, of course,
yes.
The renowned investigative reporter who has recently written a piece to show that U.S. intelligence knew that there was no chemical attack at Khan Shaykhun, which would be consistent with, you know, all of these allegations about chemical attacks by the Syrian government have absolutely no basis in reality. And if you look at some of the evidence that the United States government has offered, has adduced that these attacks have taken place. In fact, there are no evidence at all. Mm-hmm. If you actually read the documents that have been put forth, the documents amount to something like, and in fact, in one of the documents, I believe this word was actually used, this phrase, there's no smoking gun. But we believe that the Syrian government is responsible for a chemical weapons attack.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, and by the way, this plays in very much to your book, because Washington's long war on Syria makes the argument that across the board and top to bottom, the all-powerful entities collaborate with each other to tell these stories. I mean, we just heard on Democracy Now! Bernie Sanders talking, you know, and everybody's so, and he is a popular figure, but he doesn't challenge this stuff. You mentioned Seymour Hersh. He couldn't get that published in the New York Times. He used to write for the New Yorker. They didn't want it. That's interesting.
No, he's been completely ostracized. But, you know, it seems to me it's incumbent upon us to exercise some degree of skepticism. And if someone's going to make an allegation, then it should be incumbent upon them to adduce the evidence. Well, they never do adduce any evidence. And then we have to ask questions like, why would it even make sense for the Syrian government to use chemical weapons? And, you know, some people have tried to address that argument by saying, well, they're using chemical weapons to intimidate people. Well, I mean, how are chemical weapons any more intimidating than a bomb? And, in fact, bombs are far more effective than chemical weapons. One of the reasons that militaries don't use chemical weapons probably has little to do with the prohibition or the convention that prohibits them, or the fact that militaries agreed to that prohibition is attributable to the fact that chemical weapons aren't particularly effective.
Yes. In the incident that they used, that Trump used, even in that, the numbers were nothing compared to the kinds of bombs that go off all over the place.
Yes. I mean, if the Syrian government wants to kill and intimidate civilians, then it can simply bomb them.
Mm-hmm.
There's no reason for them to use chemical weapons.
Yeah, Trump himself in Afghanistan dropped what he called the mother of all bombs. And it seemed to be like a tree that fell in the forest. I mean, nobody ever showed it had any significance, but it was one devil of a blast. So it is. It really appears just to be to keep the pot boiling, doesn't it? I mean, I noticed that Macron in France, he's a little talking different after his election, but he did have a conversation with Putin where, according to the press, he said, if chemical weapons are used again, France will react. I don't know what he thinks Putin's supposed to make of that. What's your assessment of that kind of rhetoric coming from Paris?
Well, I mean, this is a very handy pretext, isn't it? I mean, this is back to the old red line. Here's the red line we're going to draw, and if the Syrian government steps over the red line, well, that provides us with a rationale for direct military intervention. That's pretty convenient, because all you have to do is wait for someone to provide some kind of some kind of occasion to suggest that chemical weapons were used, and then you simply declare that you believe that they were used. You have no evidence. There's no smoking gun, but we believe that they used chemical weapons, and you can intervene. Or
It's a commentary, isn't it, on the American media that they're actually it's blood on the floor between the American media, so-called, and the Democrats and Mr. Trump about false news and him accusing them and them accusing him. But meanwhile, they all just they don't have a problem with the most shallow, dishonest exercise of all, this thing about chemical weapons. It doesn't speak very well about the Americans' commitment to any of the principles that they lay out. And I think that's a good segue for us to talk about your article about Canada. There's all kinds of claims made by London and Washington and Paris, I guess, and certainly Ottawa, that we represent very advanced ideas and we're really good people, as Justin Trudeau said in his speech, not to Albertans, but to everybody else, and that we have these advanced values. Your article on Canada's sesquicentennial, what does humanity have to look forward to, not what Canada represents? What does 150 years tell you about what Canada represents?
Yeah, and I should make a distinction between, well, I should say that Canadians have been led to believe by the people who foster mindless patriotism that our country stands for peace and democracy and human rights and freedom. And maybe most people in the country do embrace those values. We do embrace those values, but do our governments embrace those values? No, they don't. And I think the case against that is irrefutable. And you can cite a number of reasons why our governments are not reasons, but a lot of evidence that they don't embrace those values. But we could take something or a recent event, and that is, for example, the $15 billion arms deal to sell light armored vehicles to Saudi Arabia, or the fact that Ottawa's hammered out what it calls a joint action plan with six Arab Gulf monarchies, including Saudi Arabia, which spells out how Canada is going to deepen its relationship with these countries in the coming years.
And by the way, that is without any asterisk or, you know, side remark like they tend to do when they talk about China. Or Russia, where they always say, of course, we're looking for an improvement, or we expect an improvement, or maybe we shouldn't even be doing this. They don't, when they talk to those Gulf states, they don't say that, do they?
No, and I mean, this plan sets out areas of cooperation between Canada and Saudi Arabia and Bahrain on everything from politics and security to trade and investment, energy, education, and healthcare. Now, why is that a problem? I mean, you know, governments and mainstream media like to demonize, say, North Korea as this dangerous, militaristic, belligerent dictatorship where there are no human rights and the leader eliminates his political enemies by using anti-aircraft barriers or batteries to gun them down. But Saudi Arabia is everything that North Korea is said to be but isn't, and worse. I mean, Saudi Arabia is a complete despotism. It's an absolute monarchy. There is no democracy. There are no human rights. There's certainly no human rights for women who are essentially treated as chattel of men. The country's engaged in an unprovoked war on Yemen because they don't like the fact that their puppet in Yemen has been deposed, which has led to a virtual famine. No one says anything about this, but this is an absolute aggression, a war of aggression. A complete crime, which is being facilitated by the United States and Britain. You know, Saudi Arabia is one of the chief financiers of the jihadist insurgency in Syria. And with a population less than that of Canada, has the fourth largest military budget in the world. I mean, greater than that of France, of Britain, of India, of Germany, and Japan. And we call North Korea a militaristic, belligerent, dangerous dictatorship. And yet we embrace Saudi Arabia. We do deals with Saudi Arabia. We dote on them when their king dies. I mean, in Britain, they lowered the flag. Yeah, they lowered the flag. And, of course, the president, Obama, immediately went off to the funeral. And we do deals with them. We sell them $15 billion worth of military equipment. And why? I mean, we don't care about, or our governments don't care about peace, democracy, human rights, and freedom. What we care about, what governments in Canada stand for and have always stood for, is the pursuit of economic interests. And not the economic interests of Canadians as a whole, but the economic interests of this narrow spectrum of wealthy people whose money power allows them to exert considerable influence in Ottawa. Yeah. And in this respect, we're not different from the United States. Recently, Condoleezza Rice, who was Bush's national security advisor, and had said, written in her memoirs, or she was doing an interview with National Public Radio in the U.S., and written in her memoirs that U.S. foreign policy has nothing to do with promoting democracy and human rights. She said, it's all about She said that for every president, for every secretary of state, the principal concern is U.S. security and U.S. economic interest. That's what matters. Mm-hmm. Well, that's true in Canada as well. That's what matters to Canadian governments, not peace, democracy, human rights, and freedom, but making money and dealing with, you know, these despotisms which run roughshod over human rights and engage in unprovoked wars and finance jihadist insurgencies. And if we can make money off of that, then we're prepared to overlook any concerns about war, democracy, human rights, and freedom.
Yeah, if it was the People's Republic of Southern Arabia, they'd have to pay a lot more for that oil. Yeah, even if, and they'd have to be very nice about it if they wanted to get some of that oil. By the way, we're speaking to Stephen Gowans, gowans.wordpress.com. Stephen, you tell in this essay, and I really urge people to read it, because you include a very sober discussion of when Lyon Mackenzie King, Prime Minister King, and of course he was a World War II leader, and you say, well, and he fought the right war, but he fought it for the wrong reasons, and you talk about who he was in terms of his origins and his dealings with Mussolini, Hitler. Could you give us an outline of what you learned about him?
Well, King, like many people, many statesmen of the time, was an admirer of Hitler, and he also hated Jews. I mean, anti-Semitism wasn't restricted to Germany.
No, by the way, you document, you have his, he kept a diary, bless his heart, so we know he actually wrote these things in his diary, right?
Yes, he visited Hitler in Germany, and he was very taken by Hitler.
And his policy toward Jews.
Yeah, he wrote that, you know, I would have loathed living in Berlin with the Jews and the way they had increased their numbers and were taking possession of it in the most important way. And then he went on to say it was necessary to get them out, to have the German people really control their own capital and its affairs. Mm-hmm. Apparently, King also was very concerned about Jews living in his neighborhood in Ottawa as well. He didn't like that very much. But he, like Churchill, for example, Churchill also admired Hitler and sang peons to Mussolini. And you know, these fascist dictators were admired not only by King and Churchill, but large parts of the British and North American establishment. And they were admired because they were anti-communist. Hitler was an anti-communist. Mussolini, I mean, that was the leitmotif of their political lives, was opposing communism. And that's why people like Churchill and Mackenzie King admired them.
Yeah, and apropos, you bring up the subject. You had the personal. You live in Ottawa, I believe. You say you visited the War Museum, and there I was surprised that the what do they call these things, expedition of 1918-19, is commemorated there. Talk about that.
Yes, we commemorate the Canadian intervention in, which is essentially the Russian Revolution. I mean, there were 12 countries that intervened in Russia after the Bolshevik Revolution, and Canada was among them. This hardly seems to be an event about which we should be proud, intervening in the affairs of another country. For what purpose? In this case, the purpose was to quash the revolution.
Mm-hmm.
There's still the principle of, are you going to launch military or a military excursion or intervention against a country which exerts no threat to Canada, which is something we did. By the way, something I learned about just recently, I didn't realize this, but Canada's participation in World War I came about not as a result of any decision that Canadians made. Canadians didn't decide to participate in World War I. The declaration of war was made by the king, and the governor general immediately made the declaration on behalf of Canada without any discussion about this issue with Canadians or Parliament.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something else about which we're supposed to be proud, Canada's participation in World War I. I mean, the war, anyone's participation in that is completely indefensible.
Mm-hmm. Well, that calls to mind, it's always good to remind people of the book by Jamie Swift and his co-author, his name I forget, but called The Myth of Vimy, or The Vimy Myth, pardon me. And it actually... that's one of those things that you point out. This was a king's decision. That actually ought to be revisited as a humiliating moment, right?
Mm-hmm.
For a people that want to live free, as it were, you would think they would announce that people would, among the grievances we would have is how many Canadians lost their lives without participating in this decision to fight the crime of crimes, a war.
Indeed, yes. And, I mean, this is kind of a holocaust against the working people of Europe and Canada, but also the colonial slaves who the European elite threw into the conflagration. I mean, the people from the colonies, the French brought their people from the colonies, the British brought the Indians and whoever they could essentially throw into the mob, this great...
Yes.
Industrial war of extermination. These people had absolutely no influence on these decisions. They were dragged into it.
Yeah, and again, this brings up another matter that you raise in your essay. You speak of the fact that you use a term, Ehrenvolk, that the system here was an Ehrenvolk system. So what is it, a master system, right? White masters.
Yeah. A democracy for a master race.
Because white Native Canadians did not have suffrage. And by the way, that's also true in the United States. They didn't get the vote until, I think it was 1960.
Yeah. And we didn't have true, Ehrenvolk, if we want to use that, universal suffrage for white people in Canada until 1920. I mean, after the First World War. Suffrage wasn't extended to Chinese Canadians until 1947, and not to Aboriginal Canadians until 1960.
Mm-hmm. By the way, now that you say the dates, that probably the U.S., Washington and Ottawa had a meeting and said, okay, let's do this. And they couldn't do it one place unless they did it the other, I suppose. That grew out of the expression that you use, the flag of empire. It never went anywhere without doing it by force. You say in every instance of the expansion, it was a violent deed.
Yeah, and I mean, Canada is the product of British colonialism, and we also pursued our own project of Lebensraum, for which the Nazis are known, their project of acquiring living space by expanding into Eastern Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And that project, the ideal of that project, or the model for that project, was the expansion of the British colonies in the United States and in Canada into the West. In fact, if we talk about Lebensraum, I think over a 100-year period in the United States, the United States increased its territory fivefold.
Yes.
Which was a Lebensraum policy. Now, interestingly, Hitler...
Manifest destiny.
Yeah, and Hitler trying to assuage the moral qualms of some people about his Lebensraum policy. You know, we're going to move into Eastern Europe, and we're going to take the land of the Slavs, and we're going to drive the Slavs over the Urals, and we're going to also relocate the Jews into reservations. Anyway, in response to some of the moral qualms of some people, he said, well, you know, we eat Canadian wheat, and we don't think about the Red Indians. So, yeah.
Yes. Yeah, he's invoked often, but that quote isn't heard that frequently. and we're glad that it's called to our attention by Stephen Gowans, by the way, gowans.wordpress.com. Stephen, in your essay on Canada's sesquicentennial, What Does Humanity Have to Look Forward To, Not What Canada Represents, you also, I notice, draw on three authors that are not read here very frequently. I think there might be a cultural prejudice, Diderot, Hugo, and Barbusse. And actually, you have a very shocking line from Diderot, but a very popular one, too. I think we all learned it somewhere in our lives. You were, of course, addressing it to this thing of to the Canada's relationship to these monarchs, and you said, if you're looking for religious bigots and looking for absolute tyrants, this would be them. And you, and then you quoted Diderot. I'll let you do the line. You said maybe it wouldn't be a bad thing if this happened.
Diderot had said that humanity would never be free until the last king was strangled by the entrails of the last priest. And you might say something of the same order about people in Arab Asia perhaps not being free until the last Arab monarch is strangled by the entrails of the last Wahhabi cleric.
Yes. No, it would be a good and popular slogan, I think. And to have it actually staring us in the face, where you have killers loose in the sovereign country of Syria who attack someone based on their not being the proper – being the wrong kind of Muslim. I mean, this is a case of Muslims attacking Muslims, so-called Muslims attacking other Muslims, threatening them with death and not always threatening, carrying it out by removing their heads and also saying – their slogan is Christians out and Alawi to burn in hell or some such thing. I mean, whoever preaches that way, you wouldn't mind seeing them hung up for their crimes. And who are they being sponsored by but Saudi Arabia and, according to Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and according to Qatar, Saudi Arabia.
Actually, both of them.
It's kind of hard to choose which of those you'd like to see go first. But it's wonderful to see the name Diderot and to see that quote. There seems to be an aversion here to some of the great French thinkers. And you also, of course, mentioned Hugo. You take a quote from Hugo about revolutions. Tell us that too is a very, very – I was very glad to see it. What was his observation?
Hugo's observation was about the French Revolution, which, of course, had nasty consequences for the aristocracy. But he also noted that it was a warm caress for the rest of humanity.
Yes. Yeah, and as you point out, the ones who care about having enough bread, having a roof over their heads, that they get more of those things after the revolution than they had before.
Yeah.
And you can understand why they're not as shocked by the revolution as the Blue Bloods. Again, this is Stephen Gowans. By the way, his book is Washington's Long War on Syria, and he's going to be speaking in New York at the Solidarity Center, 7 p.m., 147 West 24th Street, on the second floor, and it's handsoffsyriacoalition.net. Stephen, I want to ask, there is this, we seem to be in a situation, I wanted to ask about Canadian foreign policy. The Chrystia Freeland, our foreign minister, very foreign, has pointed out that we can't waver on this thing of confronting Russia. We have to have a hard policy, a hard power, I think is the word she used. And as a result, she gave this speech shortly before we beefed up, or at the time we were beefing up the commitment of troops, a mighty 400 of them or 500 in the Baltics. And in the process, they invited a Latvian general. And the Globe and Mail on Wednesday, June 21st, page A5, gave him quite a lot of attention. And he raised something that I'm sure that I'd like to get your comment on. Here's what he says. He came to – and the Globe and Mail had no irony in any of this reporting. They featured this quote. The West plays chess. There is a chessboard. And there are rules. And we are playing chess with Putin. But he is playing poker with us. He is bluffing, using hidden cards. We analyze him from our Western mindset. But he is different.
I've orientalized him.
Isn't that a good part of our problem? A guy can come and talk like a fruitcake nut. I mean, about a human, another culture. I mean, the Russians have been around a while. They have produced Turgenev, Tolstoy. They won a few wars. It's a civilization, and a moron like can come and say that, and the Globe and Mail features it. Talk about this problem of, or you mentioned, used the word orientalized. Or if I got the word right.
Yeah, orientalize, or drawing a distinction between civilization and barbarism and declaring that Russia is part of this barbarian world and we're part of this civilized world. So the barbarians think differently than us, and the barbarians are aggressive and so on. And who else belongs to the barbarian world? Well, Syria and North Korea. And interestingly, this is kind of a departure from the entire paradigm of the United Nations. I mean, the paradigm of the United Nations is that countries are equal. All countries are equal. And it's a regression to the League of Nations. And the League of Nations paradigm was that there are some countries that were part of civilization, and there are other countries that were part of the barbarian world, and it was incumbent upon those within the civilized world to guide the barbarians and to exercise a dictatorship.
A mission.
Barbarians, yes. And so we seem to have arrived at that place now where essentially we have an international dictatorship of the United States supported by countries like Canada and France and Britain and some countries that are opposed to that dictatorship, which you could argue are really truly democratic countries because they reject this despotism. One of them is Russia, there's China, there's Syria, there's Iran, and there are a few others that refuse to submit to the international dictatorship. And those countries are then described as part of the barbarian world. They think differently. They're aggressive.
Yeah. By the way, that was General Groby, a former commander of the Latvian National Armed Forces. He doesn't seem to know that Iranians – Persians invented chess, and Americans invented poker, didn't they? Or I don't know who started poker. But this is a seriously messed up man. But Chrystia Freeland, whose favorite country is Ukraine, when she talks about the Ukraine, she always speaks of those of the Western Ukraine have the advanced ideas, and the ones on the other side of the river are the barbarians, right?
Yeah. I mean, it turned everything on its head. also the entire idea that the United States, or not the United States, that Russia is aggressive and belligerent in this case when we move NATO forces right up to the Russian borders is simply absurd.
Yes. In his interview, this Latvian pointed out that he says, well, we have a couple of thousand troops on the border of Russia, but they've got more on the other side. That would make sense that they are Russia on the other side. But anyway, I call attention to it, and because it seems to me so pertinent to your writing, is that we have entered this world where, as we started off this interview talking about, in the case of Syria, we believe the least likely thing that they would be choosing to use chemical weapons when they're doing so well, and then in the case of talking about their attitude towards the East and towards people of, let's say specifically Russians, that somehow their behavior is barbaric when we're the ones running the armies up to their border. And the solution, I like your point, let's admit, I mean, the United Nations exists because of World War II and the resorting out of humanity, right? Which brings us to Henri Barbusse. Mr. Barbusse was a brilliant writer. When he died, there were tens of thousands of people followed his coffin through the streets, and they put each of his books on a pillow. They had people from the Literary Society of France carrying each of his books on a pillow behind him. We hardly know his name. Tell us what Mr. Barbusse had to say.
Well, one of the interesting ideas I thought that he had raised, it probably wasn't interesting or so unusual at a certain time, but today it seems unusual. I mean, he was interested in countries who are carrying out a project of making life better for humanity. So he asked the question, what does humanity have to look forward to? And we can ask, is there any country that or any country's government that is engaged in a project of creating conditions in which humanity has something to look forward to? Perhaps you could make the argument that the Chinese government is doing that for the Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
But if we ask that question and then apply it to the idea of Canada, I mean, what is Canada doing that would that contributes to creating something that humanity can look forward to? And as I thought about this, you know, I thought about a Canada that embraced the commitments of Norman Bethune, the famous Canadian, well-known, notable mm-hmm. Canadian. I'm not sure how famous he is, but he was the skilled and innovative surgeon who, from Montreal, I believe, but originally from Gravenhurst. Who I guess is best known for fighting in the Spanish Civil War and then for fighting in the Second Sino-Japanese War. But, I mean, Canada that embraced the commitments of Norman Bethune, I mean, who fought fascism in Spain, who helped overcome feudalism and colonialism in China, and who also pioneered the fight for universal health care in Canada. I mean, that would provide a model for a world that humanity could look forward to.
Mm-hmm.
In contrast to a Canada that hammers out arms deals with medieval tyrannies and whose pilots in Libya flew bombing missions for Al-Qaeda by the admission of Canadian pilots.
Yes. Yes, you have a great quote. I urge people to read this article, by the way, gowas.wordpress.com, where they did say, we are Al-Qaeda's Air Force. Of course, you, as you point out, they said it as a joke, except that it was true.
And except an Ottawa Citizen reporter had access to Canadian military intelligence files that showed that the Canadian military intelligence knew that the uprising was engineered or carried out by Al-Qaeda forces or Al-Qaeda aligned forces. They told Harper, was prime minister at the time, and of course he denied this publicly, but it was certainly the case that the Canadian military knew exactly what was going on. Which is why, although they said they quit that they were Al-Qaeda's Air Force, they must have known, indeed, they were Al-Qaeda's Air Force.
Yeah, we kind of put a burden on some of the people who carry out these terrible deeds in that they're supposed to keep a straight face and pretend they don't know what they're doing. Well, I'm very glad you invoked the name Norman Bethune. I absolutely agree. I think it provides a direction. Stephen, I guess you must be looking forward to going to New York. That's going to be quite an occasion, July 14.
Yes, and I'll also be in New Haven, Connecticut, and Rochester, New York as well.
Okay. But can people get your go to gallons.wordpress.com? Is that where they would find where you're going to be?
Yes, exactly.
Well, very good. Well, Stephen, thanks again for being with us, and it's a great sight, what's left, and we look forward to talking to you again.
Thank you very much.
Stephen Gallons, thank you.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and myself, Mimi Rosenberg. Republican health care bill stirs up toxic brew. Oh, yes. In the middle, a cauldron boiling in a dark cave, thunder. Thrice the brinded cat haw meowed. Thrice and once the hedge pig wind. Harpier cries, "'Tis time, 'tis time. Round about the cauldron go, in the poisoned entrails throw. Toad that under cold stone, days and nights has 31 swelted venom sleeping got. Boil, boil, double toil and trouble." Now, wait a minute. That's from Macbeth. Well, yes, it is. And when I think about the Republican health care bill, it comes to mind the cauldron, the thunder, the toxic brew that will destroy our lives when we need real health care. And to discuss real health care, a comprehensive analysis now of the Republican health bill,
we have U.S. Representative Adriano Espaillat from the New York 13th District and Dr. David Himmelstein, M.D., Distinguished Professor of Public Health and Health Policy in the CUNY School of Public Health at Hunter College, and is the co-founder of Physicians for National Healthcare Program, a leading single-payer advocacy organization.
And so is Adriano Espaillat. And I want to start out with our congressman. And first of all, give us a logistical, if you will, a procedural a lay of the land, why we should be so concerned and why I'm suggesting that it's toxic for our health.
Well, first and foremost, the Congressional Budget Office just came out with their report, their scoring on the bill, which states that 22 million Americans will be left without any insurance. That, in fact, this version of it, the Senate version of this health care act, is meaner than what was even adopted in the House of Representatives. It allows for a sharp Medicaid cut, over close to $800 million in cuts to Medicaid in the first years. 15% of folks that receive Medicaid will be dramatically impacted. It also allows for people with pre-existing conditions to be really hurt, since it allows states to opt out of some of the benefits that are provided by Obamacare, hiking the cost of care for those with pre-existing conditions, having out-of-pocket expenses increase, co-payments increase, and putting it really out of touch for those folks that make very little money. The poor folks are really going to be hurt by this. Those making $24,000 a year will probably face a situation where they won't have any insurance at all. So this is a serious threat to the health care of Americans across the country, and we should reject it as a nation. It is egregious that this is being done to the American people, that a plan is being put in place where 22 million Americans will find themselves kicked out of their health plans. However, there are Senate members that are not, Republican senators that are not in agreement with it. We must say also, in fairness, that that unfortunately, that some of them are not in agreement, in disagreement with it because of the harm that it does, but because they feel it does not go far enough. And so if they do get their act together and they're able to pass this, then it will come back to the House of Representatives. And the changes that are being made in the Senate will require for it to come back to the House of Representatives for final approval.
Dr. Himmelstein, some of the biggest cuts are coming in the area of Medicaid, and especially what the states may do to Medicaid once they get it, and the lack of funding that the federal government is being portioned to the states. Can we start off talking about that?
Yeah, I mean, there are just massive Medicaid cuts. The Medicaid cuts, according to the Congressional Budget Office, would total $750 billion over the next 10 years. So they're really gutting the Medicaid program, and as the congressman has said, that would mean about 15 million people would lose Medicaid coverage who would otherwise have it if this Republican bill weren't passed. That's a disaster. And just to give a sense of what this means in the New York area, there are several congressional districts. So we're talking about just an area the size of one congressional district that has about 700,000 people on average. There are several congressional districts where 100,000 people would lose coverage under this Republican bill. We have no way of delivering care to those people that really makes up for that loss of coverage. So you can say, well, we have city hospitals, we have clinics. They're already bankrupt by and large. The city hospital system has a huge deficit already. And we just will not have a way to take care of huge numbers of people if this Republican bill passes.
And as I understand it, in the states, the federal government will not be giving, this will not be an entitlement, but the federal government will be given a certain amount of money, and that once the person runs out of that money, they'll be cut off Medicaid.
Right. Well, since Medicaid was passed in 1965, the deal has been that if more people needed coverage or their care got more expensive, the federal government would chip in a share of that added expense. But this bill says no matter how much it costs, no matter how big the next recession is and how many people fall into poverty, the federal government isn't going to contribute any more. So it says to the states, you know, here's what there is, and tough luck if the needs of the people in your state go up. And that's one of the very mean aspects of this bill, which is, frankly, the most, I would say, the worst health bill we've seen in my professional lifetime, which dates back to the late 1970s.
And, Congress member, one of the things that's already been mentioned is that some of the people in the Congress, in the Senate, who were relying on to not cast a vote in favor, actually are more reactionary as to what they want from this bill. So where does this leave us? And put a human face on this. What does this mean for your constituents in an area that has an enormous poverty rate?
district that has a high number of Medicaid recipients. But this is also a dismantlement of programs that would have provided mental health services. Since Obamacare did provide funding for mental health services for drug prevention and treatment for opiated drugs, for maternity care, these are areas that for many years the funding, particularly mental health, has been spotty, and Obamacare provided a good level of funding to take care of these needs. So this this bill will dramatically impact in a negative way my district. And let's be fair about this. This is really also a tax bill. It's much more than just a health care bill. This is a bill that proposes to transfer the biggest transfer of wealth, of money, from working class and middle class Americans back to the rich and the insurance companies in the forms of tax cuts and subsidies. So this is really an egregious act that will put people's health in danger. So if I have Medicaid patients that normally would have gotten a special type of care because of the extra funding that we got through Obamacare, their health would now be in jeopardy. They may not be able to get the quality health care that they're entitled to. They may not be able to get any health care at all. And so the seniors, Obamacare closed the donut hole for them. This will open it up again, and seniors will be strapped for money. So this really hurts working class and middle class Americans across the country. And many states will choose to opt out of their responsibility to provide certain types of health care services, forcing people with pre-existing conditions to pay extremely high premiums and out-of-pocket expenses.
And, of course, this certainly will affect women's reproductive rights issues as well. But what is a poor Democrat, if you will, and now we're saying Democrat large, to do in relationship to this? It could pass. They could have enough gamesmanship to bring on board the Ted Cruzes. What then do the Democrats begin to do in any event in response to this terrible juggernaut that is seeking to pass this onerous legislation?
We got to continue to put the pressure on. We got Americans throughout the country should come out and be heard. There will be a massive mobilization in the city of New York by people who will speak out on how this will impact their health. And so we got to continue to push hard to create the narrative out there, to make the narrative that many people will be hurt by it, 22 million people, and we should not stand for it. We're optimistic that perhaps some senators may have goodwill and see this affecting their states in a dramatic way. Some states that are poor and folks are also will be hurt there as well. There are other senators that are opposed to it because they want there to be more cuts and that they want it to be more aggressive. And so those we have very little control over. And in fact, you know, I don't know if they will come to our side, but those that are still being flexible with regards to the needs of their constituents, I think we can approach and try to convince.
Thank you.
And Dr. Himmelstein, in terms of those people who are on the American Care Act exchanges, the Republicans have been saying that the Obamacare is in a death spiral, but it sounds to me as if this bill itself is a death spiral, especially with regard to the abolishment of the individual mandate to purchase health insurance and the effect that has on people who would buy health insurance and also the kind of health insurance they would get.
Well, it's very clear that this bill is an effort to sabotage what would remain of the Affordable Care Act. I mean, it cuts the subsidies for insurance on the exchanges by $424 billion over 10 years. And people who remain getting coverage, and many would lose it, but those who kept coverage through the exchanges would be getting substantially skimpier policies. They would have higher copayments, higher deductibles, worse coverage, and many of them would have coverage in name only. They'd have an insurance policy, but, you know, it wouldn't actually cover them to get the care they need. So it's an assault not just on poor people with Medicaid. It's an assault on working people who are getting subsidies through the exchanges. And as the congressman said, it's a massive transfer of wealth to the wealthy and to insurance companies and drug companies. I mean, there's a $25 billion tax cut in there for drug companies as well. So there's something for all of the donors to the Republican Party. And we've just published today in the Annals of Internal Medicine, one of the most respected medical journals, an article showing this is going to result in thousands of deaths. We reviewed all of the studies that have been done looking at does health insurance save lives, and it's perfectly clear that it does. And we're estimating that about 29,000 people would die each year because of the Republican plan if it's passed in its current form. I might say, you know, I think we need to do much better than the Affordable Care Act. I think that was a very, very inadequate measure. We need something much better than that. But we need to move forward, not backward. We need to go to a Medicare for all single-payer kind of program, which could clearly cover everyone and save so much on the insurance company overhead and profits and the bring down drug prices. So it would cover everyone for what we're now spending. And that, to me, is what the Democrats need to have as their response, not to just keep clinging that we can't let the Republicans change the Affordable Care Act, but to have a positive program about what they want to do and what we should do in this nation, which is to cover everyone. 28 million are uninsured despite the Affordable Care Act, and to upgrade coverage for everyone who has coverage today but has big copayments and deductibles that keep them from getting the care that they need. So we need something better.
And Congressman Adriano Espaillat, your thoughts on that, because actually I know that you do support a single-payer or a Medicaid for all system. Talk about that, please.
Well, you know, certainly that is the route to go. The question is, politically, do we have the numbers? And obviously, even the Democratic senators were enticing and trying to convince the Republican senators to come to the table and make Obamacare better, and they refused to. They did this in their own bubble. They did this in half secrecy, and they came out of it. And while they pledged that it would be a better bill than what was agreed upon by the House, it turns out that it's just as ugly and just as bad, and if not worse. And so if we don't have the numbers, we got to continue to pressure, and we must continue to try to convince those one or two senators that may be open to it, because their constituency will be dramatically hurt by it in poor states, for example. And then perhaps we get them to shift our way. But I think ultimately a single-payer plan is the route to go, and I think that we need to be in some level of majority, whether at the House or in the Senate, to have the political clout and tools to be able to accomplish it. The way we are right now, with a full control of the Republican Party, will be extremely difficult. So we got to continue to put the pressure on.
And Dr. Himmelstein, people say, well, you know, Medicare for all, it's something that is untested. It's maybe worked in foreign countries, and they don't talk about the fact that it's like Medicare here, which everybody is very familiar with and seems to work. And they also say that it's too expensive. Do you want to address those concerns?
Well, I guess the argument that it works in other countries but it can't work here is an argument that we're not as good a country as others, and I actually don't believe that. We know that Medicare runs for about 2.5% overhead. Our private insurance companies take, on average, about 13% overhead. So for every dollar we pay into a private insurance company, we get 87 cents worth of care out of it. And for every dollar we pay into Medicare, we get 98 cents worth of care. So that money is money we need to expand coverage. And it's not just that that we're wasting with our ridiculous private insurance system today. By having 1,500 different private insurance plans, we're making hospitals and doctors spend huge amounts of time and money on billing. You know, and instead of paying hospitals the way we pay a fire department, we tell them you got a bill for each Band-Aid and aspirin tablet one at a time. And, you know, what that means is if you go to a Canadian hospital, they maybe have two or three people who do the billing for the hospital, and their job is to send bills to Americans who wander across the border. And if you go to a big American hospital, we've got 300, 400, 500 people working in the billing department, not because they're inefficient, but because that's what you have to do to fight with our private insurance plan. So we know if we streamline the financing system, to have a national health insurance program, we could save so much on bureaucracy that would pay for all of the extra care that the uninsured and people who are underinsured today need. So the argument that we can't afford it, I mean, we're spending almost twice per person what Canada does on its healthcare system. And that's just terrible inefficiency. We could have Canada Deluxe, a healthcare system much better than Canada's, if we went to national health insurance. And the same is true, you know, if we compare ourselves to France or Sweden or any other civilized country that has the wealth to do it right. So we could have a terrific healthcare system if we just got the private insurance middlemen out of the middle of the healthcare system, and we could clearly afford it. The Congressional Budget Office in the past has said that single-payer wouldn't increase costs. The General Accounting Government Accounting Office, now GAO, has said that, and several estimates from private consulting firms, including one owned by the biggest insurance company in the country, United Healthcare, they've said, if you look at it, we could afford universal coverage if we went to single-payer. So we know we can do it. The only block is political, and I would say, you know, to Democrats who want to get back into power, you can't appeal to people by saying the healthcare system we have today is good enough. You need to propose how you're going to actually address the problems people still have. You need to be proposing bold changes the way Bernie Sanders did, and that's the way the Democrats can get back into power.
Well, that's a challenge for Adriano Espaillat. And Congressman, how do you proceed on the federal level with a single payer, with a Medicare for All bill?
I think there's lots of support. I'm a member of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, and we support that view. I'm also a co-sponsor in the Conyers bill, which proposes the single payer plan. And I agree with the doctor. We cannot continue just to say things are bad. We gotta come forward with plans of our own that are exceptional and that will be embraced by the American people from both sides of the aisle. Because if you're sick, it doesn't really matter whether you're a Republican or a Democrat. You're sick. You want to take care of your illness. So that's our task, and I think we're working in that direction. But in the meantime, right now, we're trying to hold the ground. We're trying to prevent a total meltdown of what we saw as a plan that could at least brought some relief to families across the country, Obamacare. And so a total dismantlement of that will be catastrophic.
And so that I don't have to come back and talk about the whole process as double toil and trouble, of fire burn, cauldron bubble, which seems like how it might have all been organized in secret. Is there a bill that we need to support, Congressman?
Well, I support the Conyers bill, which calls for a single-payer plan, and I think everybody should line up behind that particular bill and push for it now and for the future.
And I know that Dr. David Himmelstein has been organizing on this and is going to continue to do so. And I'd like to thank our U.S. Representative Adriano Espaillat from the 13th Congressional District, and Dr. David Himmelstein, who has been on the case and really knows a prescription for keeping us healthy, single-payer Medicare for all. Thank you both for joining us at this very difficult time.
Thank you so much.
I have a dream. One day. Justice.
America of the people, America by the people, America for the people. Which people are you talking about? Are you talking about the wealthy with the means to stay healthy while 47 million go without? No doubt, we need a revolution. It's time for a brand new healthcare solution. Sing it on behalf of the uninsured, because I believe so absurd for America, the so-called greatest nation, to be in a healthcare crisis situation.
One day, this nation will rise up.
Justice. Come from the land of milk and honey. But the healthcare industry's addicted to money.
All for one, not one for all.
47 million in dire straits,
excluded by greed and wealth.
So we got to get united in these states
and put the care back in health.
Come on, y'all. Sing healthcare justice for all. How can you sleep knowing you make promises you never keep? Life is short and talk is cheap. Time has come for you to earn your keep. Money and politics corrupting democracy, creating a hopeless healthcare hypocrisy. It's hard to see beyond your illusion. A misconception, lies, and confusion.
Every hill and mountain will be made low. The rough places will be made plain. And the crooked places will be made straight.
America is a melting pot.
Or is this a false accusation
of the have-to-haves and the have-to-have-nots?
We're waiting in anticipation.
Sing up hell like Johnny on the spot
in every other industrialized nation.
So when will we have what we have not got? Talking about a do-or-die situation.
No, we are not satisfied, and we will not be satisfied until justice rolls down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream.
Healthcare Justice by Charlotte Washington.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Way Out.
I write queer pop music, that's what I like to call it, and it's just inspired by the fact that I love music, I love pop music, and I love love songs, and I always wanted to hear music that I related to. So I create music from my perspective as a woman who loves women, and I hope that it inspires other people to feel good as themselves.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. German and Maltese equality activists race to cut the wedding cake. Tanzania's president vows to bulldoze queer advocates, and B. Stedwell's soulful sound sweetens Sydney's equality. Those stories and more this week, because you've chosen This Way Out.
I'm Wenzel Jones.
And I'm Monique Lukens.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBT communities around the world for the week ending July 1st, 2017. Germany is on the verge of opening civil marriage to lesbian and gay couples. The vote this week in the Bundestag, or lower house of parliament, wasn't even close. 393 I do's, 226 no's, 4 abstentions, and 7 absences. The measure now goes to the Bundesrat, the upper house, for approval, said to be a formality, and then on to German President Frank-Walter Steinmeier for his expected signature. The action follows significant pressure on Chancellor Angela Merkel to allow her party MPs a free vote on the issue. The daughter of a Protestant minister had resisted and said she voted no herself this week based on her personal beliefs. But Merkel admitted that meeting a lesbian couple, who are raising 8 well-cared-for foster children together, changed her mind on whether to allow her colleagues a free vote. It also comes ahead of Germany's national elections in September. Key minority parties that could be asked to form a new coalition government with Merkel's Christian Democrats, including the Greens and Free Democrats, had already said that they refuse to coalesce until Germany joins most of its Western European neighbors and opens civil marriage to same-gender couples.
Germany is in a race with Malta to become the 23rd nation on the planet with marriage equality. Maltese President Mary Louise Colero Preca announced following the June elections that equal rights topped the agenda of her new government, including opening civil marriage to gay and lesbian couples. The socially conservative, mostly Roman Catholic island nation has seen rapid advances in human rights in recent years. Divorce was only legalized there in 2011, and civil unions were introduced in 2014. Malta became the first country in Europe earlier this year to outlaw so-called gay cure therapy. Passage of a marriage equality bill in the Maltese parliament is said to be imminent.
Australian Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull continues, however, to deny his party MPs a free vote on marriage equality. He responded to renewed rumors this week that there was movement within his Liberal Party to draft a bill to open civil marriage to same-gender couples, insisting again, staying true to his vow to his coalition National Party government partner, that the only path to marriage equality in Australia is a national plebiscite. Critics charge that such a public vote is unnecessary because an overwhelming majority of Australians in poll after poll already support marriage equality. Opponents also complained about the excessive costs of a national vote and the requirement that every Australian citizen of voting age participate. Major companies have also pressured Turnbull to allow a free vote. The government failed to get a parliamentary majority late last year to authorize holding the plebiscite. But Turnbull told a Victoria radio station on June 27th that the party's policy and the government's policy is clear. We will not support a vote on gay marriage in the parliament until there has been a plebiscite which every Australian gets the opportunity to vote and that plebiscite is voted yes for gay marriage. A handful of Liberal Party backbenchers are reportedly still continuing to work on draft legislation to open civil marriage to same-gender couples and to push for a free vote on the bill, which would almost certainly make marriage equality a reality down under.
Elsewhere, Tanzania's President John Magufuli, nicknamed the Bulldozer, announced this week that his government would begin arresting citizens who advocate for LGBTQ rights, expel foreigners who do so, and raid gay clubs and other known gatherings of sexual and gender minorities. Anyone accused of being gay in the East African country already faces up to 30 years in prison. Gross indecency convictions for private, consensual, adult, same-gender sex can bring up to 5 years in prison and a hefty fine. Magufuli said he was willing to sacrifice foreign aid if it requires accepting LGBTQ rights. "Those who teach such things do not like us, brothers," he said, according to Agence France-Presse. "They brought us drugs and homosexual practices that even cows disapprove of." Magufuli also said that suspects would be subject to anal exams, a medically discredited effort to determine if a man has engaged in gay sex. A number of human rights groups around the world call the horribly invasive practice torture. These latest moves build on escalating government oppression of LGBTQ people in Tanzania. Magufuli shut down some 40 private health centers treating patients with HIV/AIDS earlier this year because they cater to homosexuals. And Tanzania's health minister, Ummy Mwalimu, has banned the sale of lube because she claimed it encourages men to have sex with men.
But despite fears by some of her supporters that hardline homophobes would prevent her from being elected Serbia's next prime minister, 41-year-old lesbian businesswoman Ana Brnabic won an impressive confirmation vote in parliament on June 29th of 157-55. She had previously served as Minister of Public Administration in the cabinet of President Aleksandar Vučić and was his surprise pick in June to lead the new government in the socially conservative Balkan nation. Brnabic becomes Serbia's first female prime minister and its first out leader. The government is said to be walking a fine line between its recently established closer military ties with Russia and, with the choice of the Western-educated Brnabic, its stated desire to join the European Union. She's far from an LGBTQ rights activist, however. Brnabic refused to support an effort to create civil partnerships for same-gender couples last year and has said that she is not a spokesperson for the LGBT community. All I want is to do my job as best as I can.
Meanwhile, a heavy police presence protected about 100 people in the downtown Serbian capital of Belgrade at a peaceful pride parade on June 24th. Marchers carrying banners reading, "We want life worthy of humans," celebrated the pending election of Brnabic as a step forward, but called for protections against hate violence, improved legal documents for transgender people, and better implementation of existing anti-bias laws. There were a few counter-demonstrators at the march from the Serbian Orthodox Church holding signs reading, "No to the Sodomite Revolution." However, police prevented any confrontations between marchers and protesters, and no incidents were reported.
In other news, the U.S. Supreme Court has decided that the state of Arkansas can't stop same-gender couples from being listed on birth certificates. The ruling, overturning a state high court decision, was announced on the second anniversary of the Supreme Court's June 26th marriage equality ruling. Arkansas officials had insisted that only biological parents could be listed on birth certificates. The Supreme Court issued what's called a summary judgment against that policy without having even heard oral arguments. The written decision repeatedly cites the justice's 2015 marriage equality ruling and seems to impatiently point out that among the specified rights, benefits, and responsibilities of marriage in the ruling, we expressly identified birth and death certificates. Three justices opposed the decision, however. Newly installed Trump Justice Neil Gorsuch wrote that opinion, joined by fellow dissenter Samuel Alito and Clarence Thomas. A child's birth certificate is frequently used to establish a familial connection that, for example, can allow the named parent to make medical decisions for a child or to enroll a child in school.
The Supreme Court also announced that it will hear a case involving a Lakewood, Colorado baker's refusal to make a cake for a gay couple's wedding because of his religious beliefs. Masterpiece Cake Shop owner Jack Phillips says that marriage is only between one man and one woman, and claims that forcing him to bake the cake for the gay couple would make him complicit in their wedding and thereby violate his freedom of religion. After failing in Colorado's courts, attorneys for Phillips from the far-right Alliance Defending Freedom successfully convinced the Supreme Court to take the case. It will be their first to weigh the ability to discriminate based on religious belief against the civil right to be protected from discrimination in the public sphere. The High Court's next term begins in October.
And finally, you'll soon be able to walk all over two of Hollywood's queerest stars. Well, actually, they're soon-to-be stars on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. The trail of individually named stars down the sidewalks of Hollywood Boulevard and adjacent streets was created in 1960, and as the promotional material says, they celebrate the glamour and excitement of Tinseltown. RuPaul has been on a roll lately, with last year's Emmy for hosting RuPaul's Drag Race and this year's renewal of the popular show for a 10th season. He'll soon be getting his Walk of Fame star. The gay brain behind Glee and American Horror Story, Ryan Murphy, will also be getting a star. He and RuPaul will be joining TV's original Wonder Woman, Linda Carter, Hamilton's Lin-Manuel Miranda, and musical performer Mary J. Blige among the new stars on the Walk of Fame, along with a TV host everyone loves to hate, Simon Cowell, and, at long last, Minnie Mouse.
That's News Wrap for the week ending July 1st, 2017. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org. You can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Wenzel Jones.
And I'm Monique Lukens.
Hi, this is Janice Ian, and you're listening to This Way Out. Support your local public radio station. You ain't gonna get this nowhere else.
Singer, songwriter, producer, filmmaker Bea Steadwell is a one-woman queer pop powerhouse who's creating lots of buzz from her home in Washington, D.C., all the way to Sydney, Australia. On stage, Bea, that's just B-E, Bea composes her jazz a cappella and folk blend songs live using loop pedal vocal layering and beatboxing. In the studio, she produces her own albums and she shoots and edits her own music videos. After appearing with Tashi Reagan's Big Lovely Band at the Women's March on Washington in January, Bea headed for Sydney's Gay and Lesbian Mardi Gras. While there, she was a featured speaker at the eclectic afternoon discussion party known as Equality and spent some one-on-one time with This Way Out correspondent Barry McKay.
Please welcome all the way from Washington, D.C., Bea Steadwell.
I write queer pop music. That's what I like to call it. And it's just inspired by the fact that I love music. I love pop music and I love love songs. And I always wanted to hear music that I related to. So I create music from my perspective as a woman who loves women. And I hope that it inspires other people to feel good as themselves.
Temper of violence, even your silence is loud, 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 loud. No one could miss you. You're a balloon in the crowd, crowd, crowd. Oh, baby, if you'd turn your head, you would see me staring, but you can't, cause you just a flirt. Oh, baby, you a flirt, and I can't say shit. I'm just an introvert. Oh, you just a flirt. Oh, baby, you a flirt, and I can't say shit, cause it would never work.
Trump has created a big step backwards and sort of a need to fight, to organize, to, you know, really create a picture of what we want to see. And yeah, the Women's March on Washington was like the March on Washington, just a place to share love. You know, that's the feeling that I got when I was there. It was about love. It wasn't an anti-Trump march. It wasn't an anti-Republican march. It was about, like, I love queer people. I love black people. I love women. I love trans people and wanting to make sure that they're going to be okay.
You, but everyone else wants it too. Oh, baby girl, why can't you tell with me? You can just be yourself. Oh, just a flirt. Baby, you will flirt.
I don't know if I can speak for the whole community, but from my perspective, knowing that there are white queer people, there are rich queer people, I don't believe marriage equality is at stake. I think in the States, it's nobody's going to touch that. But in terms of AIDS and HIV, in terms of, you know, poverty, queer folks and homelessness, I'm thinking that we need to do more work now with this administration.
Thank you.
So being black and queer and a woman in the States really sucks. It sucks probably everywhere. But what I love is my community. And I did want to say one thing. You know, we have marriage equality in the States, but when it happened, it did not feel over. It didn't feel like we could celebrate. You know what I mean? It felt very much like, all right, now we have to keep helping our brothers and sisters. Now we need to talk about AIDS and HIV. Now we need to talk about prisons. I'm excited for Australia to get there, but I do hope that we all, as a queer global community, keep in mind that that is not the only goal. All right, so this is unrelated, but this next song is about love and loneliness in this age of technology. It's called Netflix. Dow, dow. 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 Dow, 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 dow. Dow, dow,
it's
dow,
love. Maybe you should text her.
Dow, dow,
this love abbreviated dow, letter.
Dow, dow,
look
dow,
down and type until your neck hurts.
Dow, dow,
romance dow, is retro dow, as a record.
Dow, dow,
we get in bed with a device.
Dow, dow,
we fall asleep dow, by the screen
dow,
light.
Dow,
sex
dow,
is elusive on a good night.
Dow,
Netflix
dow,
is fucking
dow,
up my sex
dow,
life.
Dow,
fucking
dow,
up my sex life. Fucking up my sex life.
Dow,
hey,
dow,
fucking
dow,
up my sex life. Fucking up my sex life.
Dow, dow,
hey,
dow,
I wanna buy my girl a necklace.
Dow, dow,
I wanna cook the girl
dow,
some
dow,
breakfast.
Dow, dow,
I wanna sell a bunch of records.
Dow, dow,
come back and make the
dow,
girl breathless.
Dow, dow,
real life.
Can't nobody hear me.
Dow, dow,
real life. The girl dow, don't really dow, feel.
The world needs a very big shakeup. And part of the silver lining of Trump, in my opinion, is that people are no longer apathetic. Obama was incredible and created a lot of opportunities for a lot of people, but nothing is perfect. Nothing is enough with this government, with this system, and we cannot stop fighting and organizing and asking for more. So I think that right now, This is a time for us to really, really come together, and it's happening, and we're going to shake it up. We're going to do it.
Dow, 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 dow,
dow, dow.
Hey, let's take a picture of the good times. Let's take a picture in the good light. Let's make it look like a good night. Let's make it look like a good life. We get in bed with a device,
dow, dow,
we fall asleep
dow,
by the screen
dow,
light.
Dow,
sex
dow,
is elusive on a good night.
Dow,
Netflix
dow,
is fucking up my sex life.
No, we will never reach utopia with the queer community. There,
yeah,
there will always be struggle and conflict, and that's okay. You know, as long as we come closer to loving and listening to each other, I think that's fine.
Colors in my cup of coffee, watch the green swirl as it do, find myself get lost in movement as I lose myself in. Colors in my cup of coffee, watch the green swirl as it do, find myself get lost in as I lose myself.
It felt, even before we achieved marriage equality in the States, that the people who were focused on marriage equality were privileged. They were people who weren't thinking about folks in prison, folks with HIV and AIDS, folks who are marginalized. And when it did go through, there was a feeling like, this is great, but there's so much more that we need to do. There's so many more people who are not safe, who are not comfortable in their own homes. I mean, it does feel like such a great sort of tagline and a great sort of marketing campaign to say, you know, love is love and let me get married and marriage is beautiful, but it's just such a small piece of the whole pie.
She is what you know. Tell yourselves you'll never go.
So one of my favorite things to do is write sad love songs, and so I'm going to do one last song before I finish up. Do you guys want something sad and really depressing, or happy and, you know, upbeat? What's the vote for sad and depressing? Oh, this guy. All right, it'll be cathartic. But yeah, that's part of my thesis is, like, you know, we're allowed to have our hearts broken and cry over it and listen to music and be ridiculous like everyone else. So this song is called Blind. I'm that blind mouse running round the maze, happy with my bit of cheese, happy to be safe. And I'm that dumb girl they all talk about. She thinks she's so happy and she still ain't figured out. Love should move me just like a boat and sail. Love should clarify, but it's just a veil. And I'm that dumb girl they all talk about. She thinks she's so happy and she still ain't figured out. I wanted for so long simple, happy, nothing crazy. But I loved you for so long, blindly, blindly. I just can't see. Baby girl, she loves to have her fun. And the sky would fall down if she can't get what she wants. Baby girl, she just wants to be free. When she's gone, I'm left alone. It's something she can't see. You're my ignorance. You're the ghost of bliss. I know love can hurt, but not feel like this. And when I've loved, I've turned a cheek or two. Though I know you're hopeless, I'd do anything for you. I wanted for so long.
da 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 simple, happy, nothing crazy. I loved you for so long. Da da da, blindly, I just can't see wrong. No, no, no. Da da da, wrong. So long, da da da, simple, happy, said nothing crazy. But I loved you for so long, da da da, blindly, I just can't see.
That was musician filmmaker Bea Steadwell sharing her thoughts and some of her songs at the Sydney Gay and Lesbian Mardi Gras Equality and with feature producer Barry McKay. Bea is back on tour in the U.S. performing and showing her film Vow of Silence. For more information, check out her website, steadwell.com. Thanks for discovering This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. This week, Wenzel Jones, Monique Lukens, and Baron McKay contributed program material with thanks, as always, to Steve Pride. Bea Steadwell performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Ivana Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and our listener donors for making this program possible. Look for This Way Out on Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and Google+. Smile at Overnight Productions on Amazon, email tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on Grateful Dread Public Radio, Nashville, Tennessee, KDVS Davis, California, 2BBB Bellingen, New South Wales, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Y'all stay tuned.
studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Capitalism appears to be a permanent fixture in our world, as chaotic and unequal as it is. We're told that there's no alternative to it, and any attempts to get rid of it will end badly. But my guest today argues that in the next 2 to 4 decades, capitalism will be gone. What replaces it has everything to do with the strength of the forces of right and left. To talk about the end of capitalism, I'm joined by sociologist Emmanuel Wallerstein. He's the father of world systems analysis and senior research scholar at Yale University. His many books include the multi-volume Modern World System, and he's a contributor to the recent work, Does Capitalism Have a Future? Emmanuel, let's talk about where we got to where we are now. It's so easy to focus on the particulars of Trump in the American context, but far-right, quasi-populist politics have found significant support elsewhere in the world, especially in Europe. What were the forces that took us to this place? What has risen and what has been displaced?
We, all of us, have been operating within the framework of what I call the modern world system, which is a capitalist world economy and has been in existence for 400 to 500 years. It was originally in a relatively small part of the world, Western, Northern Europe, and parts of the Americas. It expanded by its internal processes till it englobed the entire Earth. That structure is the structure which was the basis of our lives and within which we operated. It was a historical system, meaning by system that it's something that is stable and repetitious, and historical meaning it changes at every millisecond. So that's it's not a contradiction, it's a reality. You have to take that reality and live with it. So now, like all systems, whether we're talking of the universe as a whole or the most micro system that you can think of, it has a life. It comes into existence. It has its normal life, and because of its internal processes, it comes to a point where it can no longer operate and renew itself in its proper way, and we call that a structural crisis. And a structural crisis is not a crisis of a second. It's a crisis of quite a long time. And when you're in a structural crisis of the world system, which is what we are in, there's a bifurcation. By a bifurcation, technically, what physicists mean by a bifurcation is that there are two solutions to the same equation, something theoretically impossible, but in fact occurs. And it makes it a fork. You can move in one direction or the other direction. And while at one, you can't know which way the thing will end up going, you can, in fact, affect it enormously. So that's where we are. We're in the structural crisis of the modern world system. The structural crisis of the modern world system is by definition, highly chaotic. By chaotic, you mean it swings wildly in all directions, right, at all times. So that's extremely confusing. And people don't know how to handle it, but they do. They handle it one way or the other. And now people are talking about the neoliberal effects and the, shall we say, the right-wing populism, etc. All that are responses, modes of responding to this crisis, how people handle it in various ways. And this crisis, however, poses itself as a struggle, between people who would like to move the hand, who would like to strengthen one prong of the outcome. So what are the prongs? And I created names for them, but names are unimportant. For me, one is the spirit of Davos, and one is the spirit of Porto Alegre. And what do I mean by that? The spirit of Davos are those people who have accepted the reality that capitalism no longer works for capitalists and want to replace it with another system which has all the worst features of capitalism and perhaps could be even worse than capitalism, right? That's the spirit of Davos. And the spirit of Porto Alegre is the spirit of those people who would like a system that has never existed in the history of the world, which is one that is relatively egalitarian and relatively democratic. So there we are. We're pushing in these two different directions. Now, when people talk of what to do about it, what I say to them is, of course, you do those things which will push you in many ways to in the direction of the spirit of Porto Alegre. And the problem is even more confusing than that, because in each of these two prongs, there are two versions of what you do. In the spirit of Davos, one version is the way we powerful people could handle this challenge is to hit the others over the head and hit them as hard as possible, right? And they will quiet down and we will have our way. And there's another group who says that won't work because when people are hit over the head, they resist even more. And what you have to do is you have to follow the path of de Lampedusa the name of his book?
The Leopard?
Of course. The protagonist says to his very conservative grandfather, we must change everything in order that nothing change, right? So you have to persuade people that they are changing when they are not really changing. So they are split. And on the side of the spirit of Porto Alegre, there are those who say what we have to do is create a situation in which everybody does their own thing and tries to listen to each other. It's called horizontalism, right? And because if you have a vertical structure with control, you are in fact not going to change the system. That's the horizontalist. And the verticalist says that's very well, that's all well and good, but in fact, at that point, you'll be hit over the head by those other guys, and you won't get anywhere. So instead of two positions, we have four positions, and that's even more confusing.
Sure.
And then, so today, some people are saying, well, what we should do is resist. I'm all for resistance. I'm very, but what does it mean to resist? See.
Indeed. And I want to ask you more about the conundrum, and you're describing it from above and from below. So getting to this moment of crisis and then what comes out of the crisis and the contending ideas, let's just say on the left and on the right for that moment.
I'm happy to say the left and the right. I have no trouble with that.
All right. But let me talk to you before we get to those competing forces and questions. Let's talk about the nature of that crisis. So you're not talking about a crisis that just developed over the last couple years. You're talking about something deeper. And I wonder if you could tell us when you see the crisis of the modern world system beginning, and what's the nature of the crisis? You alluded to it. You said that the conditions for the renewal of the system have been impeded in some way.
Well, the way the system got renewed always is that, how shall I say, it operated in terms of cyclical rhythms that went up and down, except that's how we think of them. But in fact, if you look at it carefully, they went up and then level and then up and then level. Okay? Well, if you do that and you begin to measure what's happening, at a certain point, you get pretty close to the top. Go up and level. If the vertical axis is a percentage of something, for example, the percentage of people who are earning wage labor or so forth, and you go up and then level, then you get to a point where you can't go up anymore because you're approaching the asymptote. And it seems the estimate of people who do these analyses is that when you reach about the 80% point, you begin to shake. And when you begin to shake, instead of, a big change resulting in a big thrust resulting in very little change, it becomes a little change results in very big change. Okay, so what basically happened is that the mechanisms which enabled capitalists to make their profits have reached this point of shaking, they aren't guaranteed any longer the possibility of profits, or they're not guaranteed the perspective of making more, and therefore, most people think that a crisis like this is only because the people in the bottom are unhappy. The people in the bottom have always been unhappy, so to speak. What's added to that is that the people on top are unhappy as well. That's new. That's the crisis. That caused the crisis. When did this? I date it from the early 1970s onward, more or less, as this period in which we are in this, what I call in one of my books, hell on earth, because it's so devastating. We don't know what is going to happen in the short run, in the middle run, and so forth, and we find ourselves extremely frustrated by the, how shall I say, the wild swings that occur. So
now, and is this unhappiness from the top evenly distributed around the world system? That is, are the conditions of reproduction of capitalism equally a problem?
Capitalism has always been a world system. It's never the idea that capitalism exists in a country is a mad idea. It has no reality whatsoever. So if I am a capitalist located in country X, my inputs and my potential sales are calculated in terms of the world system as a whole, right? So when you say, is it all evenly distributed, the negative effects may be greater or less in one part of the world or another, but in terms of the system as a whole, it's the people on top who are not able to be assured of the kinds of profits that they have been, and therefore look for alternative ways of retaining the kind of unequal income that they profited from for several hundred years. And that's where we are.
The program is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with renowned sociologist Emmanuel Wallerstein. So in terms of thinking about how we got to this moment and the forces that have produce this crisis, and I do want to talk to you quite a bit more about thinking ahead beyond this moment, but just staying with this moment. You were talking about
different cycles that take place and the intrinsic problems that happen along the course of the cycle. And I wanted to ask you more about that. How should we think of history moving in cycles? What constitute these cycles? And I know you write about more than one kind of cycle, but how should someone who hasn't thought about any of this in cyclical terms understand what may seem like a whole lot of economic chaos as being cyclical?
Well, all of life is a series of cycles. It's just a question of which are the sort of most important ones or the most have the most effect on our lives. But, you know, think of it as breathing. You breathe in and you breathe out. You breathe in and you breathe out. There's no way of not having a cycle in that sense. The question is, and that is what happens when you breathe out as opposed to breathing in and so forth. So that's the idea of having this step. Okay? So there are some things into which we put a great deal of effort. We have cycles that have to do with the economy. They have a name too. They're called Kondratiev cycles, right? And what seems to happen is that the economy expands steadily for roughly 25-30 years. And then it can't expand anymore. Why? Because the way the economy expands in a capitalist system is you have relative monopolies. You can't make money if you don't have a relative monopoly. But relative monopolies are self-liquidating for a whole series of reasons. One reason is if you have a good thing going, right, then other people want to get in on it. And there are various ways of getting in on it. And if enough of them get in on it, then they're no longer as profitable as they were. And that's when you have to pull back. And all I'm saying is when you pull back for various reasons, you don't pull all the way back because it's the resistance to pulling back also exists. So the compromise is to be more or less stable for another 25 to 30, 40. These numbers are arbitrary, but they're real. I mean, we can measure Kondratiev's over 500 years and see that the A phase and B phase, the expansion and the contraction phase, have been, on the whole, 50 to 60 years combined, okay? And until they reach the point that they can no longer operate. So that's one major cycle. And a second major cycle is the geopolitical cycle. One of the important things about capitalism as a system is you need kind of relative stability in the geopolitics of the world system in order that people can create those monopolies. So in order to create a monopoly in the economic sphere, you have to create a monopoly of geopolitical power. Those are even harder to create. But we've had, in my view, three of them historically, the which I can name in terms of the zone that was on top of the system at a given point. First was the United Provinces, which we now call the Kingdom of the Netherlands or the Netherlands plus Belgium, and then there's the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, and then there was the United States, always united, but that's a small point. And what happened is after the Second World War, after 1945, we entered into the most extensive monopoly, Kondratiev cycle that we had ever had, so that it went further up and more extensively than prior to that. And at the same time, it was the high point of the geopolitical cycle with the U.S. as the dominant power. Now, what happens is, therefore, that we have the biggest of each of these, and they both begin their downturn circa the 1970s. So it's the biggest, and then it's the, how should we say, the biggest difficulty. And that's how we enter into this situation in which we are today, and which we don't know the outcome. It's intrinsically impossible to predict the outcome because it is a function of an infinity of many of micro actions and micro moments at micro levels, right? But we can't predict, but because it's, how should I say, so chaotic, we can affect it. Because during the normal previous couple of hundred years, what would happen is we would put in enormous social energy into changing things, and very little would happen. I usually use as my examples both the French Revolution and the Russian Revolution. The French Revolution was an incredible input of effort to change the system. And if you just look at it in terms of where we are, not in 1789, but in 1850 or 1873, we had basically moved back considerably. So that the change, the real change, was very little. The same with the Russian Revolution. An immense input. And when you look at it in 1970 or so, and you say, how much has really changed? It turns out that very little has really changed.
So what you're suggesting, if I understand you correctly, is that although there are these cycles that we can see over periods of time, that these don't necessarily then predetermine the kinds of changes that happen at these junctures.
Absolutely don't predetermine it at all. They just predetermine the fact that we are in a crisis where every mini action affects us. And that's what brings us then to resist, right? The concept of resist is a concept that says, oh, goodness, these right-wing forces are basically strong everywhere, my country and in other countries and so forth, and they're reinforcing each other. What can we do about it? And the answer is resist. But resistance also, there's a problem with resist. It's a question of temporality. There's what I call the short run and the middle run. Turns out that people live in the short run. We have to eat every day. We have to sleep every day, right? We have to survive every day. So we're very concerned with what happens today. And today is a period maybe of a maximum of 3 years. A capitalist entrepreneur who invests his money, he has a perspective. His perspective is, can I make my basic money back within 3 years? Otherwise, who knows? I can't predict further than that. If I can't expect to make it back in 3 years, I'm not going to invest, okay? So what is happening is that people have to worry about the short term, and a movement that attempts to move them cannot ignore these things. So they have to do things that will help people in the short run. I call that minimizing the pain. You can do things. You can try to pass a bill through a legislature. You can try. There are all kinds of ways in which you can try to move things in the short run. And you can succeed, perhaps. You can minimize the pain by increasing the amount of redistribution here or there. But minimizing the pain is not transforming the system. That's the point to remember. Minimizing the pain is minimizing the pain. And it's a good thing to do, but it isn't changing the system. And changing the system requires a kind of... Minimizing the pain requires compromises with all sorts of people. Lesser evil kind of idea. But the medium term with transforming the system requires quite the opposite. Requires saying it's you've got to move in this direction. There's no compromise with the other direction. So that's, again, the problem of the movements, of resisting. Are they thinking about the short term, or are they thinking about the middle term, or do they know how to think about them both simultaneously? Well, it ain't easy. That's the real point. None of this is easy, right? And we all make mistakes all over the place. Looking back on what we've done 100 years from now, people will say, my God, why did they do X? That was so stupid. We should have done Y. Yeah, but that's 100 years from now looking back, and we're in the middle of it. So we can make mistakes all over the place, and all I can say is, try your best. Do what you can. Resist by minimizing the pain. Resist by not compromising with the other side whatsoever. And hope. It's in effect, you hope that all of this adds up. Because what happens with the bifurcation is at one point or another, enough forces are on one side rather than the other so that it tilts. And that side becomes the new system.
That's the voice of sociologist Emmanuel Wallerstein. We'll take a music break and be back with him. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with sociologist Emmanuel Wallerstein. His many books include The Multi-Volume Modern World System. He's senior research scholar at Yale University. And my name is Sasha Lilly. So we were talking about, you've been talking about your prediction that in 20 to 40 years approximately from now, that the crisis that we're already in, the crisis of the modern world system, is going to come to a head in some way, and in a sense echoing Rosa Luxemburg's notion of socialism or barbarism, it could either go in a positive anti-capitalist direction or a very negative direction that would be not capitalism, but potentially something worse. What does that bleakest option, how might you envisage that looking? The worst case scenario.
The worst case scenario, I think the worst case scenario is simply that we have a new system which is inegalitarian and undemocratic, but which is, how shall I say, solidly based, begins its own process of whatever the rules they set up, the normal period of a system is the system operating by the rules they invent, right? And you can't know what all the rules are that you can't predict what all the rules are that they will invent. For example, I often say, look, suppose we were sitting around a table in the year 1450, 1500, and we said to each other, boy, this feudal system in Western Europe is coming to an end for X, Y, and Z reasons. So let's create a new one. We'll call it capitalism. And here are the kinds of institutions which we'll need to set up. Do you really think that anybody sitting in 1450 or 1500 could imagine all the structures that would get created? And the answer is, of course, obviously not, because these structures come into existence in the process of the operation of the system. So if you ask me what the system will look like, I can't tell you. I can only tell you, right, whether it is tends to be inegalitarian, hierarchical, polarizing. That's what we now have or what we're coming out of, or whether it's relatively egalitarian and relatively democratic. Again, I say relatively because nothing is perfectly anything, but we can do a lot better than we've ever done before. And I want to emphasize that there's never been a case, none of these so-called past socialists or blah, blah systems of various kinds were, in fact, relatively egalitarian, relatively democratic. So it isn't a question of trying to revive one of those systems. It's trying to create a system which the world has never known but is theoretically possible.
Would you think of the worst-case scenario, and perhaps not the worst-case scenario, I'm not sure, as both being forms of class society? Would it be fair to say that the bleakest option of all would be some form of class society, just not this one, and the other form would transcend that?
They would be a class society, of course, but in the sense that they would be hierarchical, right? And they would be exploitative, and they would be polarizing. So they get worse and worse as time goes on. So you want to call that a class society? I'm perfectly happy with the language, as long as we know what we're talking about, right? The problem with all our languages is they're all so laden over with historical usages that almost always I have to wonder when somebody says something to me what they mean by it. And I have to try to read into, or how shall I say, figure out what people mean by using a word like class society. But I have no objection to it. I would call that a class society, sure.
So what would crucially be different than just staying with the most sort of odious possibility for how society might go coming out of this crisis, how the world system would go? What would not continue? I mean, you talked about hierarchy and polarization and exploitation, which are all hallmarks of capitalism. But there obviously have been societies that have been hierarchical and exploitative that haven't been capitalists, obviously. And you've written that you see capitalism as a system of accumulation without end. Is that what would be fundamentally changed in a society that was, let's just say, highly reactionary but not capitalist?
And that's an interesting question. I'm not sure I know the answer to that. The endless accumulation of capital is my defining feature of a capitalist system. So if you had a non-capitalist system that was nonetheless exploitative and so forth, would they center around the endless accumulation of capital? They might not. They might not. I can't know exactly how they would organize things, except that they would organize it such that the outcome was exploitation, the outcome was hierarchy. But structurally, whether I would doubt it, as a matter of fact, because I think that's a defining feature of the capitalist system. It would not necessarily be the defining feature of another kind of awful system.
But you, of course, are also arguing that this is not the only way things could go, and that there is an opening, a possibility of moving beyond capitalism in a more egalitarian way. Now, I know that you've just said that we can't look into a crystal ball and picture a society that goes entirely beyond whatever we've experienced, but do you have, when you suggest that there's this sort of Porto Alegre avenue, let's just say, at its base, are there things that you imagine would be essential in terms of getting beyond capitalism?
Well, you know, I kind of believe in the human imagination. And what that kind of situation would do would be to release the human imagination to thinking about how they could maintain a system, maintain it as relatively egalitarian and relatively democratic, because there would always be people within it who would try to undo that. You know, they speak in, especially in Latin America, they speak of Buen Vivir, which is itself a translation of an Aymara word and of a Quechua word, and it means to live well. But what does that mean in English? It doesn't mean anything per se. But what they try to mean by it is that there would be some kind of human interaction of people that would try to see what way we could choose something that would end up being more egalitarian or more democratic, so that it would require a constant kind of discussion that would not rule out possibilities. Now, this is in my, if the spirit of Porto Alegre wins, right? So I see it as an open society, as one that permits you to think of new possibilities all the time, present them to others, defend them, amend them, and release your imagination. I think that's very important as an idea, and which you find very strongly argued by somebody like Ilya Prigozhin in terms of the structure of the world that could be made, could be created.
Well, I realize I'm sort of pushing you to take the very long view with some of these questions, but you had mentioned that, and you've written that capitalism is a system and hence has a beginning but also an end. In thinking about life beyond capitalism and thinking about the more egalitarian path beyond capitalism, should we also think about whatever comes next is also having a life cycle?
Well, you know, it's quite, in a sense, any system has a life cycle, by definition. Right? Any system has a life cycle. But I do know someone who argues that we are going to move into a relatively egalitarian one, and then after about 500 years, we will move. He sees a cycle of moving between these two back and forth. I'm not ready to say that. I'm not ready to say that. I don't know that. That's, how shall I say, he has a cyclical process beyond my cyclical process, okay? And he may be right, or he may be wrong. How could I'm not trying to be evasive. I'm trying to give people a realistic idea of what their options are and what their best choices are in a difficult situation.
Emmanuel Wallerstein is my guest. He is the noted sociologist. Amongst his many books, he's a contributor to Does Capitalism Have a Future? I'm Sasha Lilly, and you're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I was wondering if you think there are any danger in making grand predictions about the future, including that capitalism will be replaced by something worse or better in 20 to 40 years. Are there pitfalls in doing so, especially if the prediction doesn't, end up coming to pass?
There is a danger. And the danger is that people will think it's hopeless and they will retreat into a shell, in a sense. And they will then not be active. And by not being active and not resisting either in the short run or the middle run, they more or less guarantee, in a sense, that the other side will win. So I do worry that anything that I say will persuade people that they will reduce their willingness to push in the right direction. There's also the danger my arguments can be used against me by people who are not on my side. I have been told, they are now quoting you to say we are right and so forth. So yes, it's a danger, and yes, I worry about it, and yes, I do what I can. That's in the end, I do what I can, and I'm urging everybody to do what they can.
Well, in the time that we have remaining, let's talk about that struggle to fight, in essence, the good fight, to influence things in one direction and rather than another in the midst of crisis. To what degree does how we understand the world, to what degree is that the terrain of struggle? In thinking about particularly the forces of the left, if we want to call them that, or radicalism, there has been in many quarters, a real rejection of the universalisms of the left of the past, and in many ways, a focus on the particular against such a thing. And I wonder if that turn leaves us in any way in any kind of quandary, and particularly in terms of the kind of struggle that you're talking about to influence the direction that things go in the future, obviously, is a tremendous struggle. Well, and so does that need some kind of way of unifying people beyond the particular?
Well, I respond to that kind of question the way I respond to a lot of other questions, which is the impossible is the most possible. The impossible is to be simultaneously universalist and particularist, as it's the impossible is to be both structural and historic. And we have to learn how to do that, and that is not easy. So I can only again say, of course you have to be the simplistic universalisms were part of the dominant intellectual structure of the capitalist world system, the binary splits that all sorts of people in the last 10, 20, 30 years have been denouncing. They're right. Those were terrible. to go to the other extreme and say, therefore always be particularist, there's no end to that. If you're particularist, your particularism is within the particularism, and at the end, you're left with absolutely nothing. If you follow particularism to the end of the stream, everything is disintegrated. And so it's helpless, and then the other side can just walk in. So how can you be both universalist, that is to say analytic, okay, which I'm trying to be, and take into account particularisms, which I'm trying to do, both in the short run and in the middle run, right? And again, let me say it's not easy.
Let me end by asking you about this particular moment that we happen to be in. You've been stressing a much longer view and the culmination of forces over a longer span of time. But we do find ourselves in a moment where the far right is in power in this country, and much has been discredited. Yet, in terms of what replaces what's been discredited, is still very up in the air. Do you see that there are openings right now, both in terms of domestic politics in the United States and then also the question of U.S. Sure. imperial ambitions, which were sort of on display recently with the Trump's attack on Syria, which was sort of a fascinating moment because, of course, some people had held on to the hope of a silver lining with far-right populist kind of isolationism against the hawkishness of Clinton, and it seems like we now have the worst of all possible
worlds. I wouldn't give up the silver lining yet.
You don't think so?
No. I think we have a man in power named Donald G. Trump, J. Trump. Anyway, Donald Trump, who had the astuteness to combine being the head of a social movement and being the candidate of a political party. And basically, his power has resided in combining the two, which no one ever did before, basically, or never successfully. Now that he is the president of the United States, with all the technical power that gives him and control of various things like armies and so forth, he still wants to be the head of a movement because his power in the United States comes not from being president of the United States or the head of the Republican Party. His power comes from the fact that he has a movement which is behind him and which follows him or seems to follow him for the time being, no matter what he does. I mean, he himself said that I could shoot somebody on Broadway. I could shoot somebody in the middle of the street and they still would follow me, right? And in a sense, he was absolutely right. Now, he hasn't given that up. And Syria is a good example. What has happened? Well, he's been under pressure from all sorts of sides to bomb somebody, okay? At a certain moment, not too long ago, he gave the order, bomb, okay? And since he's the commander-in-chief of the armed forces, they bombed. And then what? Well, everybody says, well, what next? Okay, so he has all sorts of people who are presumably in his cabinet, in his inner circle, and in this, making statements about what our policy is, not what it should be, what it is. And it turns out they're making different statements. And everybody's making a statement except one person. That one person is Donald Trump. So he isn't making a statement. We don't know what next. What we do know is he will decide what next, but on what basis? and we don't know. And in fact, this uncertainty is part of his power. So I don't know, you don't know, whether he's going to send more troops in or not send more troops in. He loses whatever he does. That's the reality of the situation. But that doesn't mean he won't do something terribly stupid. Something which will have consequences which are so negative that the world will bemoan it, right? Because he could do that. I give him a lot of credit for, how shall I say, I don't think he's stupid. I don't think he's ignorant. I think he's very astute. And I think he's, how shall I say, feeling out the world and trying to figure out what he could do that would be the least harmful to him in his power and the United States as its power. Well, okay, fine. But I don't know what that is, by the way. And I don't know that he's going to find out what that is. So he may do nothing. That will not be good for him either. He's got a lose-lose situation. The one thing I'm not sure of is if he recognizes that he's in a lose-lose situation or he thinks somehow that he can still get on top of it. So,
well, on that cheery note, Emmanuel Wallerstein, it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with the sociologist Emmanuel Wallerstein. He is senior research scholar at Yale University, author of scores of books, including Decline of American Power and Uncertain Worlds. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.